Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Canada. We should move to Canada.
Well, the celebrity getting his hair cut in a downtown Toronto barbershop is Desmond Cole, a prominent freelance writer and activist. Desmond Cole's journalism, especially on the topic of being black in Canada, has been known to get the whole city talking and to land him on television.
I appreciate it, though.
I appreciate you, Desmond. All the times I see you on television, I feel proud, man. So proud to see a young black man, you know what I mean, voicing himself for the community who have yet to found a voice.
That is a scene from a new documentary airing on CBC television tonight. It follows Desmond Cole as he traces the story of anti-black racism in Canada. The documentary is called The Skin We're In. Desmond Cole is with me in our Toronto studio. Hi.
Hi, Anna Maria.
What's it like for you to have the man who cuts your hair tell you how proud he is to have you using your voice?
It means a whole lot to me because the work that I'm doing is primarily for our community. You know, it's for our black communities, I guess I should say, across the country. So when I get to meet people who have read something that I've done or who experience my work and who are grateful for it, who are black, that really does mean everything to me because I know that they understand why we need to talk about these issues. It resonates for them without us having to have any prior conversation.
The film is about anti-black racism in Canada, and it's important for you to define it as anti-black racism. We are not talking general racism. Why is that?
Because racism doesn't affect everyone in the same way, right? I always think, for example, of the term antisemitism, which everybody understands is racism, but is a specific kind of racism that affects Jewish people in specific ways. Anti-black racism is denoting the same thing. It's saying that racism is happening to black people in this country and in all over the world in specific ways, in specific contexts, with a specific history behind it. So you can't just say racism to cover all forms of discrimination. It happens to different people differently. And in my case, I feel like we need to talk specifically about anti-black racism because it's showing up in very specific ways in our country, and we won't deal with it by blending it in with everything else that's
until
happening.
We label it, we can't actually pinpoint and deal with it.
Well,
properly,
yeah.
Then.
I mean, for example, the classic stories that we hear about black women and men being followed in stores when they shop. This is something that's very specific to us as black people, but it plays into a larger idea of anti-blackness that says that our bodies are a danger that always needs to be contained. Wherever we're going, we need to be scrutinized by security or police, even if we're just shopping in the store, because we might get out of hand. So that is a specific feature of anti-black racism that manifests itself in the world in specific ways. That's why it's important to know these things.
And we are talking about Canada, but you go to Ferguson, Missouri, because Ferguson really resonates with you. Why is that place and what happened there so important to you?
Well, as everyone will remember, in 2014, a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri named Darren Wilson killed Mike Brown, an unarmed 18-year-old who was on the side of the street. And after Trayvon Martin had been killed in the United States and after the Black Lives Matter movement had started, and Mike Brown's killing really triggered something in that town. Ordinary people who had never been to a protest before, who had never really been out in the street, were furious at the lack of justice for Mike Brown. And they started protesting for days and then for weeks and then for months continuously. And I was captivated by this from Canada. And when they decided not to charge the officer, to charge Darren Wilson, I thought, I have to go down, because there was big protests happening. The National Guard had been called into that scene. While I was in Ferguson, I saw a protest in Toronto, 3,000 strong, for Mike Brown. And I saw that, just like how it was resonating for me, what had happened to him and how people were fighting back, I saw that it was resonating in my own country by the thousands. But I also saw that the reason there were 3,000 people at that protest, in part, was because of stories here like that were similar to what was happening with Mike Brown.
Except they weren't getting the attention.
Not at all. So, for example, you know, we had Jermaine Carby, who was in Peel region and who was shot and killed by a police officer. The police said that Jermaine Carby had a knife on him, but the SIU didn't find a knife at the scene of his crime or where he was murdered by the police. So, I mean, we had that happening here and we were talking about Mike Brown. So it really inspired me to say, people want to talk about these issues and I have to bring my work back home to make sure I'm focusing on those issues where I live and not just talking about Ferguson, not just talking about the United States.
How do you think violence against Black people in the U.S. does shape the conversation in Canada?
I think that, to paraphrase Rinaldo Walcott, a professor here in Toronto, that what happens there amplifies what happens here. What I notice is that there is often an attempt to make what happens in the United States the whole story. A Black person talks about an experience of anti-Black racism here in their city or in their country, and immediately someone turns to them and says, well, it's not as bad as in the United States. That is the most demeaning, disrespectful answer you can give somebody who's talking about their experience of racism where they live. It's to tell them that they shouldn't worry because it's probably worse somewhere else. We don't live in that somewhere else. We live in Canada, and we have our own distinct history of anti-Black racism that needs to be tackled here.
And also, when things happen, they don't always make the news across the country the way everybody picks up on something happening in the United States.
So just this week, for example, we got news that a police officer named Daniel Montesson in Ottawa would be charged in the death of Abdirahman Abdi, a 37-year-old man who was beaten to death by Montesson and other police in Ottawa. That should have been a national story, but it wasn't. The fact that the police in daylight could chase a man through the streets and beat him in front of his own apartment building, and he died there. Why? I mean, we show clips of this happening to men in the United States. But when it happens in front of us in our own country, we don't. And I think that that's that classic Canadian dodge. It's newsworthy somewhere else. But if it happens here, maybe there was a reason. Maybe we should wait and see. Suddenly, all those same racist excuses for violence, we see that we're using them as Canadians as well.
How much of that is the media not picking up on something that then people read about and get outraged and take to the streets? And how much should Canadians be taking to the streets more?
How can they take to the streets if they don't even know it's happening? If we're not providing the coverage, how can people be aware of the scale of the problem? I think this is exactly like collecting statistics about anti-Black racism and how it's happening in our schools, how it's happening in our public services, how it's happening across the board, because we often don't have statistics for things in Canada about Black people. And we say, well, they're only 3% of the population. We have all these excuses again. But how are you going to know if you don't actually keep numbers and detailed statistics? You can't do it. So if we want to be curious about this stuff, then we actually have to share the information with people. We can't expect there to be some uprising against racism that's not being called out.
And I guess along with that comes then the accountability of journalism having to then go to people who are elected to say why and continue the accountability questions.
And if I may, Anna Maria, because I'm glad we're having this kind of conversation about this, our media itself is uncomfortable with dealing with the issue of anti-Black racism and just capturing it and documenting it the way that we do about other things. So let me give a really simple example. There is a situation here with a school board trustee recently in York Region. This school board trustee back in November was at a public meeting. There was a Black parent at this public meeting, and the school board trustee called that Black parent the N-word, called that Black parent that word in plain sight and hearing of other people, and then denied it, refused to step down from her elected position for months. The number of times that I saw the word allegedly in stories about her calling a woman the N-word, but it wasn't alleged. She acknowledged that she said it. She apologized for it. But our media kept saying allegedly because it was as if, well, we have to leave some room that maybe the Black person is making it up. We have to leave some room that maybe this is all a misunderstanding. Hey, maybe the N-word just slipped out innocently. These are all things that not only does the general public accept, but even our media accepts things like that. So it's really hard to have these conversations because even the reporting on it is always trying to give racism the benefit of the doubt.
I'm going to play a clip. And this a warning, there's offensive language in this tape. They use the N-word in this tape. And we're playing it because it's archival footage from a TV interview with people on the streets of Halifax. It's actually from 1962. Let's listen.
Is there a color bar, a Negro problem in Halifax? Does the colored man get a fair shake?
I think so. You don't hear tell them being molested or anything like in the States or anything.
We're in a white country predominantly, and anything different is something different.
Do you think the Negro people get an even break?
Yes.
No discrimination?
No discrimination. A few years back, there was discrimination.
Now, have you ever tried to go to a white barber? If you're happy with your Negro barbers, you don't need to go to a white barber.
Well, but Negroes, not niggers.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say nigger.
I don't even know what to say after that clip. Ooh. That's the reporter who used that word.
That's right. And was corrected. And what was the first thing he said when he was corrected? He said, I didn't mean to use that word. So the Black person that he's interviewing on the street has to endure the pain of having that word said to them by a person in the street who's supposed to be interviewing them and is immediately told, well, get over it. I didn't mean to say that. Nothing has changed. That clip's from, what, 55 years ago? But in terms of the way that we respond to racism, nothing has changed. People engage in racism now, and they say, oh, I didn't mean it. Oh, I'm a good person. There was a senator this week, a Canadian senator, who was talking about the residential school system in this country, and who said that she was disappointed with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission because it only focused on the bad things that happened to Indigenous children in residential schools. Residential schools that took thousands, untold thousands of Indigenous children away from their parents and killed them. And if they didn't kill them, tried to take away their language, tried to take away their culture. A Canadian senator is out here in 2017 saying, yes, but the people who were behind those schools were well-intentioned and they did good things too, and we should look at that. We continue to deny racism and genocide in that case of Indigenous people in this country. And so that's why I think these issues are still so timely, because you saw the denial back then and it hasn't changed.
And in fact, you go to Red Deer, where you grew up, and you meet a family. Who did you meet?
We met a family that immigrated to Red Deer just in the last year and a bit. And they're a family of eight, of two parents and six kids, who came as refugees. So they came as refugees from Democratic Republic of Congo to Red Deer. And I thought this was interesting because this is the same trip from the continent of Africa that my family took 40 years ago. And I wanted to interview another family who had just done this trip under different circumstances, mind you, because my family didn't come as refugees, and just say to them, what's it like living in Red Deer, which is a primarily white place, which, you know, their kids had to get enrolled in school and acclimatize themselves. And it was really an interesting and fascinating conversation because they too are, I think, like my family, grateful for the opportunity to have come to Canada, but they also experience discrimination here.
In fact, let's hear the clip.
There's like a lot of ignorance as to like where we come from.
Do kids in Africa go to school, or
how come you speak good English and you're from Africa? You know, stuff like that. Like they expect
less of you because you're an immigrant, or I don't know, maybe because we're black.
There was actually one time there were a bunch of kids behind me and I was just seated, and then they were like, am I being racist if I say that I don't like the way black people look? And I was like, excuse me. And I just turned, looked at them, and walked away. Like, you don't want to take it any further. You don't want to fight them.
So they're getting it. They're getting that kind of conversation.
How could they not? You know what I like about this country, Anna Maria, is that we've developed a very sophisticated defense mechanism that whenever we hear racism, we pretend like we're shocked. But black people are not shocked at the clip that you just played. There's probably very few black people in Canada who haven't had a conversation, a very painful one at that, like the one that was just relayed in that clip.
It's interesting because when you wrote the cover article for Toronto Life a couple of years ago, The Skin I'm In, you made that point. You talked about being stopped by police and the carding, like 50 instances that you can count of being stopped on the street because you're a young black man walking down the street. And you said at the time, people I know go through this every day. The rest of you don't realize it. And one of the girls in Red Deer asked you, they wanted to know if you had to act more white to get where you were today. That great divide that many, I'm going to say many of us, I'm a white woman talking to you, that we don't see every day, but you live every day.
Well, that was a fascinating question that I got from this young woman who asked me that, so you're a journalist, you are prominent. Did you have to, in her words, act white in order to get to the spaces that you're in? And like this, I think, really reveals the heart of what we're really talking about when we talk about anti-black racism. Because what we're talking about is white supremacy. So the idea that I, as a black person, could so-called act white, what does that mean? It means that even as black people, we know that there is a certain expectation, there's a certain standard of what it means to be a Canadian, and that standard is based on whiteness. It's based on the idea that whiteness is supreme in this country, that people who are white made the laws in this country and that that's a good thing, that the customs of white people should be celebrated in Canada and that's a good thing, that the indigenous culture that was here for thousands of years before is just completely erased, and that those of us who want to be Canadian, who want to fit in, have to mold ourselves into being something that white supremacy finds to be acceptable. And you notice I'm saying white supremacy and not like white individuals, because you mentioned it. This is a systemic thing. This is an institutional thing. This is a history thing. It's not about one white person saying a mean thing like that reporter did in the clip.
It's about an expectation or it's about a privilege that we don't even know we have.
Yeah, well,
or maybe we do.
Well, I think I'm glad you said that, because I do think that, again, the way that white supremacy is maintained is always through this innocent denial. I don't know what you're talking about. Oh my gosh, there was an instance of racism. Oh, I'm shocked. And people
to open our eyes.
Well, people say privilege. Maybe power is a better word. Maybe the exercise of power by people who benefit from white supremacy is what we should be talking about, instead of some accidental privilege that people were born with.
Desmond Cole, thank you for your work. Thank you for making us think.
Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on.
It's time for our documentary of the week from Tom Powers and Raphael Inhausen, co-founders of the Doc NYC Festival and the Pure Nonfiction Podcast. Here's Raphaela with this week's pick.
If you were a black woman who wanted to make a film in the civil rights era, the doors were mostly closed. But Madeline Anderson managed to overcome the obstacles. In 1960, she directed a short documentary called Integration Report 1, capturing snapshots of race relations in the North and South. One segment covers a black Brooklyn man shot by police. Here's attorney Thomas Russell Jones addressing an assembly.
Killed as a result of a policeman's bullet fired at him while he was in custody in the 79th Precinct on Gates Avenue.
This man who had not even committed any crime, he failed to put a bottle or trash in a can. And this trigger-happy cop took him in.
Anderson gained early support from the pioneering filmmaker Richard Leacock. She went on to work in New York Public Television in the 1960s on the show Black Journal. Then, in 1970, she released her next film, I Am Somebody, about the battle to unionize black women hospital workers in Charleston, South Carolina. Here is Coretta Scott King addressing the workers a year after her husband's assassination.
I feel that the black woman in our nation, the black working woman, is perhaps the most discriminated against of all of the working women.
For many years, Madeline Anderson's films have been hard to find, but tomorrow night she will be in person at the Metrograph Theater to present these two films along with another short, a tribute to Malcolm X. For more information, visit wnyc.org/docs.
This happens every day.
2 years after his release from jail, Khalif Browder hanged himself at his home in the Bronx. He was 22 years old.
If I would have just been pled guilty, then my story would have been never been heard. Nobody would have took the time to listen to me. I'd have been just another criminal.
In recent years, we've heard a number of stories about the ways the criminal justice system has failed someone or some people. It's always painful and it's always troubling, but it's particularly troubling when the person at the center of the story is someone young, someone whose life is changed by a broken system before his or her life has even really begun. Now a new documentary tells such a story in excruciating detail over six parts. The series is about a high-profile case out of New York City. It's called Time, the Khalif Browder story, and it profiles the life of 16-year-old Khalif Browder, who was arrested and accused of stealing a backpack back in 2010 when he was on his way home from a party in the Bronx. He wound up spending more than 3 years in the notorious Rikers Island jail complex, much of it in solitary confinement, before the charges were dropped. His family went public with his story, and his case became a cause.
Khalif Browder.
Khalif Browder
was arrested at 16.
Stealing a backpack.
In jail.
Solitary.
But the experience destroyed Khalif. He committed suicide less than a year later after his release. The six-part documentary premiered on Spike TV earlier this week, and the series director, Jenner First, joined us in our New York bureau to talk about it. And I started by asking him why Khalif's story struck such a chord.
You know, there's this horrible, tragic thing happening and, you know, the instantaneous loss of life in a gunshot or in, you know, a horrible incident that's captured on video. And in talking with Khalif's mother, Vanita, you know, she lamented about the fact that people don't understand, you know, my son was killed over years. He was murdered and it's just different. And, you know, I would listen to her and, of course, I would empathize because he really was. And it wasn't just one moment in time. It was time itself. It was his whole life as a young black man growing up in the Bronx. And he really was a child of the system, born into foster care because his mother had a drug addiction, went to failing schools, was a victim of stop and frisk many times. And he went to Rikers Island, which was, you know, notorious for abuse, corruption, gangs, you know, an uncontrolled amount of violence. In his story, there was everything. And we were dealing with something so poignant and so focused that all we had to do was let his story rise to the surface and viewers could see it.
Just to let people know in part what you're talking about here, I mean, he was stopped along with a friend. The friend was allowed to go home. He thought he was going to be allowed to go home, but part of the reason that he wasn't, that he was sent to Rikers, is that he was on probation for an earlier incident. And just to just describe what a little bit of what you're talking about, I want to play a short clip from the film where he talks about how he felt about what that Rikers experience was like. Here it is.
When they sent me to Rikers Island, I was 16. I would say it was like hell on earth. Sometimes, you know, I feel like I'm never going to be the same. You know, I smile and I joke a lot, but, you know, deep down, I'm a mess because it's like I'm 21 and in the inside, I feel like I'm 40.
One of the things that the film does is make it graphically clear what it is that he's talking about when he talks about it being hell on earth. And some of that footage was obtained, as I understand it, by Jennifer Gonerman at The New Yorker, who reported extensively on this. Can you just describe, though, for people who have not seen it, what exactly he's talking about?
The security camera footage that Jennifer Gonerman was able to acquire a portion of and release through The New Yorker, we acquired the remainder of it. And essentially, it depicts an environment of chaos and violence unchecked by corrections officers. And at one instance, violence at the hands of correction officers. In one of the videos, Khalif is shown being slammed down on the ground for just appearing to do nothing more than talking back to a corrections officer. He's shackled behind his back. And, you know, it's scenes like this that really bring to light the type of chaos that happens on Rikers Island.
The film explores a number of issues. I mean, the fact that he was kept at Rikers for 3 years without ever facing a trial. But why do you think is solitary confinement such a big issue? And why did that part of it become such an important part of the story?
Well, I think that's the most horrific thing of all. We're doing things to people that we do not even allow to be done to animals and testing. Animal rights groups have done a lot of activism to stop housing and isolation for animals in laboratories. Now, we find that to be a cause, yet there's millions of Americans in extreme isolation. The United Nations has ruled more than 15 days straight as torture. Just to contextualize, when Khalif was 17 years old in his first extended stay in solitary confinement, he stayed over 300 days. He was a child. His brain wasn't even developed yet. And we know from testing that that type of experience can cause permanent brain damage. The experience of being incarcerated is traumatic enough to think that he would be in a cell, you know, 9 by 12 for 23 hours a day, at times being denied recreation and at times being denied food. He was starved on multiple occasions. For a young man, for a child, to have that happen to them, it's absolutely horrific had they even been convicted of a crime. But the most shocking thing in Khalif Browder's story is that he wasn't convicted of a crime. You know, folks don't understand, jail is different than prison. These folks haven't been convicted of a crime yet. They're awaiting their day in court, yet we're torturing them, and we're doing it to children. So it made Khalif's story so poignant and so much an example of the system not working and the system essentially destroying people and their families.
I understand that you're also obviously appreciative of Spike TV for giving you the time to tell the story in the way that you wanted to tell it. But Spike TV has not traditionally been known for producing this kind of documentary or featuring this kind of documentary. In fact, I understand that in an earlier discussion around the film, it has been raised that one of the network's current staple programs is Cops, which some have criticized for kind of glorifying this kind of macho image of policing, which would seem at odds with the picture that your series presents. And, you know, I say that as a person who comes from a policing family. I have six police officers in my family. So I don't say that from a position of hostility. But the fact is there are those who would question, like, why is this the place to present this particular work?
For me as a filmmaker, I've had the great honor of working on a couple docuseries that were tackling real issues in America, and the viewership was there. But Spike has access to 100 million homes and has bravely gotten behind the message of this series, which is criminal justice reform, has been unafraid and hasn't sanitized a single thing that we've been trying to do. So to me, that's about the biggest megaphone that you can get. To answer your question about Cops, as a filmmaker, I view that as an opportunity too. If you have viewers sort of lulled away by a violent depiction of our inner cities and policing and sort of the inequality in our system, and then all of a sudden they get slapped in the face with something like Time, the Khalif Browder story, that's a moment right there. That's a chance to change someone's perspective about something that they may have previously been confused about. And now they get to see the human being behind that occurrence. They get to see their mother, they get to see their family, and they get to see the collateral damage that an encounter like that with the police can cause. So I find this to be an incredibly educational moment for all Americans, even those who watch and are entertained by Cops. And I'm very grateful for the opportunity.
That's Jenner First. He's the director of the new documentary miniseries Time, The Kalief Browder Story. The first of six parts premiered this week on Spike TV. It will be airing Wednesday nights going forward. And Jenner First was kind enough to join us from our studios in New York City. Jenner First, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Black police showing out for the white cop.
It is Friday, and that means StoryCorps. And for the family we'll meet today, long conversations are something of a family tradition. As a kid, Cameron Henson listened for hours as his grandfather, Leonard Simmons, told him stories about being a police officer in Newark, New Jersey. Leonard died in 2013, but his stories are living on through Cameron and his mom, Tony. At StoryCorps, Tony remembered how her father ended up on the force.
Dad was working in a factory, and he would get off work really late, past when the buses would run. So he would have to walk back home. Through Hillside. Hillside was majority white. And the cops used to stop him. They would always ask the same question, where are you going? Where are you coming from? And that would make him angry. And I remember him saying, one day I'm going to own one of these houses in Hillside. So he joined the police force. And that was where I grew up.
I remember I really truly believed that grandpa was bulletproof. Like my grandpa's an actual superhero. Yeah, it could probably fly. Did you ever worry about grandpa being a police officer?
I never worried, you know. He loved catching a bad guy. But one time, street informants told him there was going to be a robbery of a bar. So he and his partner walked in, and he actually was shot at and shot the perpetrator. That was the only time that he killed a man. And he was hailed a hero, but I think he felt as though he failed. I remember hearing him weeping at night because he had taken someone's life. That's why he was such a good cop. He looked people in the eye and he saw them.
What would you say Grandpa was most proud of?
His kids. He loved you. You know, firstborn grandson.
I remember his wallet only held four pictures, and all four pictures were of me.
Mm.
When Grandpa came to visit, I would put on my Timberlands just to make sure that he knew that I was getting taller.
I didn't know that.
And Saturday mornings, he would take me to IHOP. One particular time, one of the ladies next to me looked at me and picked her purse up and put it on the other side of her. And Grandpa said, you don't have to move your purse. My grandson ain't never stolen nothing before in his life. And that meant the world to me. I still haven't completely gotten over his passing.
I want you, Cameron, to know how much Grandpa loved you. But I don't want you to ever feel like you're off the hook. The legacy that you leave is the one that honors him.
Absolutely. I try to be just like him. And I want him to continue to be proud of me.
Cameron Henson with his mom, Tony, in Atlanta, Georgia. Their conversation will be archived at the American Folklife Center in the Library of Congress and also featured on the StoryCorps podcast.
Mama, I got dreams.
Little brother. I heard y'all ain't hitting in New York. Word. I heard y'all ain't hitting in L.A. Word, word. I heard y'all ain't hitting in North Carolina.
Historically, black communities in the South often face a range of economic and political challenges. Many were built during the Reconstruction era on land considered undesirable by white residents. Today, some communities still face challenges when it comes to access to clean water and sanitation. A new documentary project called In Conditions of Fresh Water explores the legacy of structural racism on people in Alamance County in North Carolina and Lowndes County in Alabama. The project is currently on display at the Duke Center for Documentary Studies. Danielle Purifoy is a co-creator of the project, and she's also a lawyer and environmental social scientist. Danielle, welcome to our program. Good to have you here.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Also with us is Omega Wilson. He's president and co-founder of the West End Revitalization Association. It's a community development organization that works to improve life for residents in Alamance County, North Carolina. Welcome back, Omega.
Thank you very much.
And joining us also is Catherine Flowers, a native of Lowndes County, Alabama, the founder of the Alabama Center for Rural Enterprise, and also in residence at Duke. Hello, Catherine.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Our pleasure. Danielle, I want to start with you because you partnered with an artist to pull together this project. Tell us about your partner and kind of what's behind the project.
Sure. My partner's name is Torquase Dyson. She is a visual artist that is based in Brooklyn and currently an art lecturer at Yale University. I met Torquase back in 2014. I was looking to connect with other African-American women who were working on environmental justice and race and space generally. And what happened was there was a visiting artist grant that opened up at Duke. I forwarded along to her, and she said, well, why don't we do something together? And that's kind of how the project was born. I was at the time doing some research on historic Black towns in the post-bellum era and learning a little bit about how the sort of histories of where a lot of these Black towns were placed were on undesirable lands, as you said, and created a sort of structural environmental inequality that was reproduced over years through in access to basic infrastructure, basic amenities, as Omega Wilson says, like access to clean water and wastewater sanitation infrastructure, sidewalks, paved roads, all of those things that contribute to the growth and economic development of a town. And Torquase liked the idea, and so we ran with it. And so we've been working on this for about 2 years.
How did you choose Alamance County in North Carolina and Lowndes County in Alabama?
Sure. So I have been attending the North Carolina Environmental Justice Summits, which happen every October for a little bit. And that's how I met Omega Wilson, probably back in 2013. So I'd already known about their project. And then I'm a student at a PhD candidate at the Nicholas School of the Environment at Duke. And Catherine came and gave a keynote lecture in October of 2014 about the wastewater sanitation and infrastructure challenges in Lowndes County. I ended up doing a research project that following summer. And the parallels between the two places in terms of their history and in terms of the infrastructure challenges really made it an interesting project to do as a kind of comparative study.
Well, Omega Wilson, tell us about Alamance County and what are some of the challenges?
Well, some of the challenges date back to the end of slavery in 1865, where communities, there are several communities in and around the city of Mebane. Mebane City Limits is now in Orange and Alamance County, where freed slaves were placed or allowed to buy property in these kind of little hostile type communities. They've been there. Cemeteries, churches with cornerstones dating all the way back to 1868. Several 100-year-old churches in these communities. The one that I was born and raised in and went to school in is West End. Another one that is part Native American and African American north of Mebane is White Level. And Buckhorn and Perry Hill, a twin community of similar age and old cemeteries, is just on the Orange County side. And most of these communities, as far as infrastructure is concerned, have basically stayed frozen very much, as the city of Mebane is identified as the fastest growing city in Alamance County, one of the fastest growing in the state, and right now exploding with one of the largest mega industrial and distribution parks being built in the eastern part of the United States.
But you find that the communities you're talking about aren't even hooked up to the sanitation systems or the water systems in the same way that the residents of Mebane are.
Exactly. What happened in 1999, we filed a complaint against the North Carolina Department of Transportation, the city of Mebane, Alamance County, with the Department of Justice relative to a plan to build a interstate corridor, eight-lane interstate corridor right through Mebane, right through where my wife and I live, as a matter of fact, right through the cemetery where slaves were buried and people who were born into slavery and died free are buried with the cornerstones saying exactly that. People are still being buried there, called a community cemetery, literally right across the street from our home. And at the site where interviews were done with Danielle and Taquazi, and photographs were taken for the project. And what has happened is a growth related to the highway corridor was to build a huge industrial park and a distribution park. But a lot of the growth has excluded these communities. Mm-hmm. We've been marginalized. Now, West End part has gotten some sewer connections for 100 and some houses, but about 104 houses. But there are over 500 in the other communities that still have not been touched, even though the city of Mebane is doing a new growth plan, a long-term mm-hmm. growth plan, to expand the city by thousands. And that growth plan, again, excludes these communities.
Catherine Flowers, how do things look in Lowndes County, Alabama?
Well, Lowndes County is, as you know, is located between Selma and Montgomery, and lots of people come through there often, but people don't realize that a great majority of the people in the county live with raw sewage on the ground, and that's because the soil doesn't perk. That's the rate in which the soil absorbs water. Also, there are high water tables, so the cost of an on-site system is very expensive, more than the average person there can afford, and it's one of the poorest counties in Alabama, one of the poorest in the country. And as a result, there's raw sewage running on the ground. The people that do have on-site systems have complained that they don't function properly when it rains, especially with the climate changing and we're seeing more and more rain events. The sewage backs up into the house and can come in either through a sink or a bathtub. And we've also seen instances where in one town that has a lagoon and there's a street that runs alongside the area where the lagoon is located with houses on either side. And when it rains, it overflows not only through the backyards of the people on the side that lines that street, but on the opposite side of the street as well. And we have actually partnered with Baylor's National School of Tropical Medicine and collected fecal soil water and blood samples and our preliminary results, which we have not published yet. In the unpublished study, we're going to reveal that we found some evidence of tropical parasites that are emerging in the area because of these conditions. Mm.
And how does it compare to other places around it? Is this a strictly rural area, or are there cities and sort of urban areas around the places we're talking about?
It's between Selma and Montgomery, but we found out that this problem is throughout the Black Belt region of the United States, and Lowndes County is just exemplary of how people have looked the other way, and there has been no public investment in dealing with this. In Montgomery, which is not that far away, Montgomery has public infrastructure, and I'm sure that a lot of the infrastructure in Montgomery was funded by public funds. We probably find the same thing in Selma, Alabama, although there's some areas outside of Selma that have the same problem. So in the rural communities, Flint was flawed infrastructure. In a lot of these rural communities, there's no infrastructure, and there's been no infrastructure investment, and it's been left on the backs of homeowners, in a lot of cases, people that are poor and people that are minority.
In Conditions of Fresh Water, it is an art exhibit and a documentary exhibit on display at Duke Center for Documentary Studies through June.
Hello, Morehouse!
Following up now on some other news from the White House, last week more than 60 presidents from historically Black colleges and universities, or HBCUs, met with President Trump in the Oval Office after meeting with Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. Now, those meetings have been the subject of a very great deal of social media commentary because of Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway's sitting position on a sofa and remarks by DeVos that some found historically inaccurate and insensitive. But the substance of the meeting was President Trump's signing of an executive order moving the initiative on historically Black colleges and universities from the Department of Education into the White House. But he didn't make any other specific commitments. And all of this has caused backlash on a number of HBCU campuses where critics say the meeting was little more than a photo op. We wanted to know more, so we called John Sylvanus Wilson, Jr. He's the outgoing president of Morehouse College, and he's a former executive director of the White House Initiative on HBCUs, and he's with us now from Atlanta. President Wilson, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me. My
Michelle.
So as a former director of the White House Initiative on HBCUs, you know that people were critical of President Obama's commitment to HBCUs, even though his administration extended some, what, $3 billion more in funding than his predecessor had done. And you noted that there was some advanced buzz around this meeting with President Trump, some hopeful buzz. What was the hope? Additional financial commitments, scholarship assistance, what?
Yeah, I think you're right about that. The hope was around funding. And the two categories of funding everyone was hopeful about was either funding to individuals through Pell Grants, which Barack Obama doubled while in office, or institutional funding through Title III. And so, you know, with advanced billing of the meeting, you know, come to Washington, we're going to have a historic meeting and this president is going to outdo all of the others. We thought that those would be the terms of success.
In a statement on the meeting that you published for the broader Morehouse community, you seem to express some disappointment with the meeting. You said that it's not possible to measure the impact of this gesture anytime soon, if ever. How did the meetings fall short, in your view?
I just think, you know, having been at the White House in the Obama administration, I was kind of well aware that you can't do everything in a single meeting, nor is it reasonable to expect you to do everything in an initial meeting. So I kind of thought this meeting would be more symbolic than anything else. Nevertheless, hopes were legitimately high. The turnout was enormous. I'm not sure we've gotten that many presidents to show up at any meeting. So I think that's how the expectation was built up. I do want to say, though, that yes, I did write a statement to my community. Never there or anywhere else did I say we got played. That is not my spirit. Those are not my words. And I don't think it was merely a photo op. It was the beginning of a conversation. And I believe there is still time for this administration to come through with some funding to HBCUs.
But there has been some pushback from students at HBCUs around the country who saw the meeting itself as essentially a photo op, allowing the president to show that he's reaching out to a constituency that did not support his candidacy, but without actually offering very much. What are your thoughts about that?
I just think it's premature to make a judgment about this administration vis-a-vis black colleges. I do understand that there's a lot of criticism from a number of constituencies and stakeholders. It is pretty clear, Michelle, that during the primaries, during the presidential campaign, you know, for the last basically 2 years, Donald Trump and his campaign have been associated with a set of values that were problematic for a lot of people, and they run contrary to how a lot of us define progress. So the notion of his outreach, you know, just coming into office to HBCUs was out of step with a lot of his messaging. So it was surprising to a lot of people, and a lot of people were, you know, cynical and skeptical about it. But again, I say, while the big announcement did not come in this 2-day meeting, there is still time for it to come. And I'm not yet cynical or judgmental. We'll see if they're going to come through.
Before we let you go, you were kind enough to speak with us at NPR when you were first appointed as president of Morehouse. It was announced in January that the board wouldn't be renewing your contract as president, so your tenure comes to an end in June. When we first spoke, I noted that about 17 of the 105 HBCUs had openings or were searching for a new president. It was a very challenging time to take on this leadership position. So what's your takeaway from your tenure?
Well, you know, I'm not finished assessing my takeaway yet, Michelle. That's going to take some time. I do have to say, though, that I still hold to the view that a subset of our HBCUs ought to go on a pathway to surge in strength and close the gap between most HBCUs and the stronger institutions in the higher ed sector, small liberal arts colleges. And by that, I mean get larger endowments, get more giving from the private philanthropic community, and just get a better physical infrastructure, academic infrastructure, pay faculty more, aid students more. There's not an HBCU that is as strong as, say, Swarthmore or Grinnell or Harvard. And that gap is pretty wide. It has widened over the last 30 years. And it's time for gap closure.
That's John Sylvanus Wilson, Jr. He's the outgoing president of Morehouse College. He's a former director of the White House Initiative on HBCUs. And he was one of the attendees at the meeting of HBCU presidents with President Trump in the Oval Office last week. And he was kind enough to join us now from Atlanta. President Wilson, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
Thank you. Now at 5:30, parents in Cobb County say a letter not enough to stop their fears about racial threats. Today we learned a student at North Cobb High School is behind the threats targeting black students.
Well, some parents say they don't think the school district is taking those threats seriously enough. Again, this is all happening at North Cobb High School in Kennesaw. CBS 46's Brittany Miller went to get answers about what district leaders are doing right now.
He is so hated right now. Like, he really shouldn't have done that.
Joseph Turco is talking about the student responsible for this racist message posted on Snapchat. In it, he calls African Americans porch monkeys and the N-word. He also calls for the mass genocide of black people.
He really does deserve all the heat coming to him because it's inappropriate saying all that kind of stuff.
It's a hate crime.
Patrick Evans is a parent at the school and says he doesn't feel his daughter is safe.
She's told me, like, she's heard this sort of stuff happening. In the hallways, you know, white students calling black students the N-word.
But it's not just black families who are talking about the school's racial tension. Do you hear other white kids use racial slurs towards black students?
Yeah, of course. I do.
Now, I did reach out to Cobb County Schools asking how they plan on keeping students here safe. A spokesperson says they plan on having additional security here on this campus tomorrow. In Cobb County, Brittany Miller, CBS.
I was the first, one of the first. My first day was state trooper coming, putting me in the back seat of the car, and meeting the other black kids with six of us. And seeing all of those parents and also KKK members having signs and throwing cans at us, spitting at us. We lived in the threat of death every day, every day. So I was just lost in this vacuum between integration and segregation and racism. That was my childhood. I was angry for years. Angry. Very angry.
Video of a fight inside a Wake County high school is going viral tonight. A 15-year-old student claims he's been the victim of racial attacks for months now at Wake Forest High School, and that caused him to snap. Tonight, classmates of Micah Speed are rallying behind him. Gloria Rodriguez talked to the teen and his mom about what happened.
This video taken at Wake Forest High School Friday is going viral. It shows 15-year-old Micah Speed grabbing a student's backpack and knocking him to the ground twice. The student responds with a racial slur.
Nigga!
What piece of...
We have been unable to reach the other student in the video, but Micah tells me the student had been racially harassing him for the past 2 months and even threatened to kill his family.
I just want to say I'm not a violent person. That's not who I am. Everybody who's known me and that knows me currently know that I try to avoid confrontation. And I usually laugh things off, but I was just pushed over the breaking point.
Today, students protested at school to show their support of Micah, asking school leaders to bring the football player back from his suspension. This Change.org petition has more than 1,300 signatures, asking the other student be suspended too. Micah says his suspension has since been reduced to 5 days from 10. But his mother says Micah had reported the racial harassment to a teacher 3 times, and it kept happening.
Everything could have been avoided, and no one was listening.
A spokeswoman for the Wake County Public School System says that they did look into Micah's alleged threats about racial harassment, but she says she can't say what, if anything, was done about it. And she also says she can't comment more on the incident, but says that they are investigating. In Wake Forest, Gloria Rodriguez, ABC 11, Eyewitness News.
Black babies cost less.
Wilmington man allegedly yelled racial slurs at two children coming home from school. Now the family is taking action for what he said. It is a story that's only on WWAY. According to the family, two boys were walking home on Kelly Road. On the way, a man stopped his car and rolled down the window yelling a racial slur at the kids and threatening them with his dogs, according to the family. Eighth grader David Williams was terrified for his life.
He points at me and says a racial slur. And there's dogs barking in his car. And so I was shaking my whole way home. I was very scared because it looked like the dogs were about to attack me.
The whole family has gone to the police about the case. Tune in at 11 to hear from David's parents about what they plan to do next.
Solo on Fire, a jailhouse lawyer story. On the morning of September 11, 2016, a man in Pennsylvania's prison at Albion awoke in the grip of excruciating pain. Dennis Solo McKeithen put in a sick call slip, and when a duty nurse appeared at his cell door, he exclaimed, "My God, what happened?" Solo told the nurse that he woke up that way. That way meant the right side of his face was swollen, and his right eye was swollen shut. His face wasn't just swollen, it was discolored, and according to Solo, was pink. That's especially disturbing because Solo is a black man with skin the color of coffee. Solo said the male nurse told him he thought he knew what the problem was, but he wouldn't say, so he called the doctor to diagnose the case. A physician's assistant appeared shortly thereafter, and seeing his condition, had him sent to a medical facility where he was given an IV and treated for shingles, a nervous disorder which causes unbearable pain. Solo said it felt like his face and right eye was on fire. Solo was prescribed an antiviral medication. Days later, concerned about continuous eye and skin pain, Solo put in a slip to see the prison's Dr. Jose Boggio. On September 29, 2016, Solo said the following encounter happened. He, Solo here refers to Dr. Boggio, came to my door. He said, "I'm Dr. Boggio, so I'm trying to tell him what's wrong with me." "Oh," he say, "oh, that's nothing. You need to win the lottery." I said, "Lottery?" I said, "What's wrong with you, man?" He said, I'm from South America. I've seen all kinds of stuff." I say, "What do that got to do with me?" Solo, disgusted with such a response, turned off his cell light and walked away from the man. Dr. Boggio responded by ordering no more treatment for Dennis McKeithen. In January 2017, Solo, a jailhouse lawyer, filed a motion for a preliminary injunction in the Erie County Court of Common Pleas. On January 17, 2017, a preliminary injunction hearing was held where Solo testified and also conducted examination of several Albion prison and medical staff. The judge, John Garhart, conducted the hearing and announced he believed that medical diagnosis and treatment standing outside a locked prison cell door could be considered a real examination. At hearing's end, he issued an injunction and ordered Solo to be treated by two outside doctors outside of the prison. One had to be an internist to examine his shingles. Solo, jailhouse lawyer, had won. From Imprison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
What country you from?
What?
What ain't no country I ever heard of? They speak English in what?
What?
English, motherfucker! Do you speak it?
Samuel L. Jackson has been critical of how casting directors have decided to cast black British actors in American films as opposed to black American actors. Now, the recent example that he gave was the film Get Out, which is a pretty good film. You should go check it out. Jackson suggested that Jordan Peele's satirical horror film Get Out, which starred British actor Daniel Kaluuya as an African-American man falling victim to white liberal racism could have benefited from having an American actor as its lead. So here's the actor that was cast in case you guys didn't see the film. And he was actually phenomenal. I thought that he did really good in the film, or did very well in the film. He says, there are a lot of black British actors in these movies. I tend to wonder what that movie, Get Out, would have been with an American brother who really feels that.
So part of Samuel Jackson's point was that, especially for movies like Selma, where Martin Luther King was played by a British actor, you know, if you live in this country, and this country honestly had a deeper history of slavery, racism, discrimination than Great Britain did, well, then you might have more visceral reaction, and that might help your acting. It's an interesting case to make. I both agree and disagree with it in parts.
Mm-hmm. So I think that the whole point of acting is that the actor is acting, right? And so I don't care if it's a black guy from Britain or if it's a black guy from the United States. I care about whether or not that guy is the best fit for the role. And so I thought that in this case, the actor did a great job in the role. And so I understand the concerns of Samuel L. Jackson, but at the same time, I just feel like it's an unfair criticism, because if you're just casting people who play themselves, then it's not interesting, right? Mm-hmm. I think that actors are supposed to act, and in this case, that's exactly what happened, and the actor was great. What does annoy me, though, is where, and this happened in a recent film, they'll cast like a non-Armenian woman to play an Armenian in a movie, right? And it's like, there's Armenian actresses, why don't you just hire the Armenian actors instead, you know?
Well, that criticism is not that far removed from what Samuel Jackson
is. I think it is. Okay, so how is it any different from a white person playing an Asian person?
So no, what Samuel Jackson is saying is that black Americans have a different experience than blacks in other parts of the world. Mm-hmm. So in fact, here, let me quote him again here. It says, Daniel grew up in a country where they've been interracial dating for 100 years. What would a brother from America have made of that role? Some things are universal, but not everything. So, look, overall, I agree with you. Mm-hmm. The whole point of acting is acting. Yeah. You take on a different role. So, and I'm not sure. And then the woman who played Coretta Scott King in Selma was also a British actress. Mm-hmm. She claimed the opposite. Hey, since I didn't live that experience in America, I come at it from a different perspective. That an African-American actress might not be able to separate their emotions out of it or whatever. Yeah. I'm like, no, that's total horseshit, right? So the part that annoyed me and where I started to agree with Samuel Jackson mm-hmm. is let me quote The Guardian here. Asked why so many British black actors are cast in American roles, Jackson replied, they're cheaper than us, for one thing. They don't cost as much. And they, the casting agents and directors, think they're better trained because they're classically trained. Now, I get the economics of wanting to hire actors who aren't as expensive, mm-hmm. right? But this whole classically trained stuff, because a lot of the British actors, you're trained in the theater. So the theater actors are better than the non-theater actors. Hate it, can't stand it, don't believe it at all. So if that gets under Samuel Jackson's skin, I totally agree with him. Theater acting is totally different than movie acting. Overall, you're black American, black British. Nah, you know, I don't think Jackson makes that compelling a case on that.
Yeah.
But the whole, on the other hand, if they think the theater actors are better, then I go back to being on Jackson's side. Like, really, Samuel Jackson, for example, because he wasn't classically trained in British theater, is not as good an actor? Hell no. I don't believe that at all.
Yeah, I just don't care. As long as the acting's good. You know, I'm being disingenuous about the whole Armenian thing either. If that person knows how to play a good Armenian actress, then fuck it. Just hire them, okay? I don't care.
But you know, look, one last thing about this. John Boyega, who is one of the stars of Star Wars, said, black Brits versus African American, a stupid ass conflict we don't have time for. So fair point, of course. Yeah. But on the other hand, he originally, I didn't know this, did the Star Wars role in his normal British accent. Mm-hmm. And people are like, that's a little unbearable. So no, do it in an American accent. Which I'm a little jingoistic sometimes. So that's why I like this story. I'm like, I'm kind of with Samuel Jackson here, mm-hmm. right? Like, people don't want to. It's British sounds snobby. So
also, it's funny because people also think it sounds smart.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And look, my British friends, I'm not getting on you. God bless your heart. And we elected Donald Trump, so you got a case to make that perhaps you might be a little smart on this. On the other hand, you voted for Brexit.
Yeah, I was about to say. Right? Yeah.
So, and of course, the intelligence has nothing to do with the accent. Of course, right? All I'm saying is, don't get on us, in this case, American actors, for not being trained in the British theater. And then we'll have Samuel Jackson lay off you guys.
But it's American casting directors who think that the theater trained actors from the, you know, from Britain are better. It's not British casting agents.
That's absolutely true.
Yeah.
And so that kind of snooty attitude where the theater is the best, not buying it.
College don't mean shit. Y'all niggas, and you gonna be niggas forever, just like us niggas.
And she apologized to you all about it, right?
Yeah, I have apologized.
But that apology over a racist text message might not be enough for this highest appointed official in East Feliciana Parish to keep her job. Good evening. That apology comes after the messages on her parish phone revealed she wanted to run a black worker off.
These messages are disturbing. Chief Investigator Chris Nakamoto here now with more on those messages and what happened to the longtime worker.
Michael, Sylvia, we were there today as she got suspended. We've been looking into this for days, and repeated attempts to get East Feliciana Parish Manager Barbara Vale to talk haven't been successful until we showed up at her office first thing this morning. The sun just started rising when Parish Manager Barbara Vale's routine Wednesday got cloudy. Vale's 31-year career with East Feliciana Parish is in jeopardy tonight over what she did on her parish cell phone.
Comments, please.
Vale slammed the door on us as she tried to get into work around 7 this morning. Police jurors say this week messages she admitted to sending to another employee became public. The messages refer to an African-American employee who worked as the parish secretary as the N-word. Employees say she was well-liked by all until she abruptly quit her parish job 2 weeks ago. These messages obtained by the investigative unit show Vale targeted the African-American employee. Vale writes to another employee, "We gotta find a way to make her quit or something." "Yeah, you right, but the N-word gotta go." Read her LinkedIn account.
Some of the jurors did say she called and apologized to them for doing it.
We were there today as president of the police jury, Lewis Kent, said this behavior won't be tolerated.
She will be suspended.
When is she getting suspended?
Today.
3 hours after going in, Vale exited the parish building toting what appeared to be Girl Scout cookies and candy as her suspension begins.
We understand you apologized for those messages. Would you like to issue a public apology? Ma'am, you're taking a taxpayer-issued vehicle home. You're on suspension. Would you like to apologize? Would you like to apologize?
Tonight we've learned Vale began calling police jurors, pleading with them so she could keep her job, and offered to take a week off for her behavior. Police juror Chris Hall and Vice President of the police jury Sean Smith say they believe Vale needs to go, since no African-American workers could ever feel comfortable reporting to her.
Good morning, Barbara.
Following what she admitted to sending on her parish phone.
East Feliciana Parish will not tolerate this. We do not condone this, and if the accusations are true, Ms. Vale will be dealt with accordingly. A special meeting was called for this Friday to discuss Vale's employment status with the parish. The personnel committee will meet before the full jury votes on what happens to Vale for her misconduct. Michael.
This is my rifle. There are many like it, but this one is mine. My rifle is my best friend. It is my life.
I must master it as I must master my life. Without me, my rifle is useless. Without my rifle, I am useless.
I must fire my rifle true. I must shoot straighter than my enemy who is trying to kill me. I must shoot him before he shoots me. I will. Before God, I swear this creed. My rifle and myself are defenders of my country. We are the masters of our enemy. We are the saviors of my life. So be it, until there is no enemy, but peace. Amen.
Arr! Arr! Huh!
local gun dealers saying they are seeing a spike in African-American gun owners.
And many of the first-time buyers are who we're talking about. Mona Kozar Abdi talked to an Ohio spokesman for the National African-American Gun Association. And Mona, he says the numbers really picked up after President Trump was elected.
That's right, Frank. Not just sales, but the club's membership grew from just 100 members in 2015 to well over 5,000 today. And gun club representative Kevin Jones says it's racial incidences like the one he experienced right here in Northeast Ohio that are firing up demand.
In the months since President Trump was elected, gun sales have been on a decline. But Northeast Ohio gun dealers say a new group of people are keeping their sales alive.
Most of them have noticed a huge amount of African-American folks interested. I have seen that go up in the recent months to about three or four times.
Kevin Jones is the co-owner of Urban Sports Unlimited. He's also the state representative for the National African American Gun Association. Jones believes the sales are being driven by racial fears.
Mainly because of the change in rhetoric that I can see. The change in rhetoric that comes from the top down.
And Jones says he saw it play out firsthand when he became the target of a racially charged road rage altercation right outside of his Parma shop.
Literally hanging out of his car, screaming the N-word. He pulled in behind me, blocked my truck in. At that point, I figured at that point I probably would, you know, need my sidearm, so I drew my sidearm.
He says the situation ended when the man drove off.
I had not dealt with that situation in many years, probably 20.
But Jones says his customers are expressing similar concerns, leading them to exercise their Second Amendment rights.
Well, I had another gentleman that called me again who had not carried in many, many years and said, I think it's about time.
And Jones says among his African-American clientele, he's noticed a significant number of older men and women interested in buying a gun. And a recent Pew study also reflected a change in opinion in the black community. In 2014, 54% of black people agreed gun ownership does more to protect people from crime than put people's safety at risk. That's up 29% from 2012. Live in the tech center, Mona Kosar Abdi, News 5.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, March 11th, 2017. So I have been told for folks who reside in the area of the world known as the U.S., I think the clocks are supposed to spring forward 1 hour if you're listening live. So for the folks participating live, let us all remember to move our clock forward 1 hour. That's it. Compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have commentary you would like to share, things that happened over the past 7 days, counter-racist suggestions, views, other things that stood out, observations. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com, racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener-supported counter-racist radio. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop us an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. Please make sure you just drop me an email to make sure you have the current physical mailing address. I did move earlier this year, so just drop a line to make sure, confirm that you have the accurate information. But again, huge thanks, sincere appreciation to all the folks who have supported us over the last 8+ years. Hope the broadcast has been worthy of your time and energy. That said, and the email address, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. That said, a few things I wanted to share, and then we will get to the callers. Someone emailed me, one of our listeners in the Chicago area, shout out to Pam, Trojan Horse, doing better. Very happy to hear she emailed me earlier in the week. One of our different listeners in the Chicago area sent me a flyer they wanted me to share. So this is the Hartzell Memorial United Methodist Church and the Black Star Project present 4 seminars on racism, white supremacy. Seminar 2, this is Sunday, March 12th. So that's tomorrow. I know it's short notice, but if we have any listeners who are in the Chicago area, Sunday, March 12th, 1 to 3 p.m. Topic 1, Black Family and Racism. Dr. Terry Solomon, Director of African American Family Research Institute. And then the second topic, Effects of Racism on Black People. Dr. Michael C. Edwards, Educational Psychologist and Editor, Black Child Journal. This is tomorrow, Sunday, and the address, it's the Hartzell Memorial United Methodist Church. The address is 3330 S. Martin Luther King Drive. So it's 3330 S as in Sam, Martin Luther King Drive, Chicago, Illinois, 60616. The number they have listed, 312-842-5957. And they even have Mr. Neely Fuller Jr. quoted on the flyer. If you don't understand white supremacy, racism, everything you do understand will only confuse you. And they have his book sourced as well. So should be constructive information. Check it out if you attend. You can let us know. Maybe you can call in next week for the compensatory call-in and give an update. Take some field notes, observations, how many folks were there, what the information that was presented. Was Dr. Welsing mentioned, one of Chicago's finest? Just give us, update on any useful information if you are able to attend. And again, that is tomorrow. If you want the flyer or what have you, drop me an email and I will get it to you directly. Next event, next weekend, I've been trying to announce this regularly. Sabrina Johnson, she was a guest on the program last year. She was one of Dr. Welsing's students. She attended many of the Welsing Institute lectures for years, many, many years. She traveled with Dr. Welsing, and they were very, very close. Sabrina Johnson, she and others, they are coordinating a commemoration and call to action in honor of Dr. Welsing. There will also be a birthday tribute to her, and they are contemplating fundraising components. This is scheduled for next Saturday, March 18th, 7 p.m. Eastern, at the Thurgood Marshall Center. This is in Washington, D.C. If you need any additional information, you can email Sabrina Johnson. Her email address is sabrinajohnson27@earthlink.net. sabrinajohnson27@earthlink.net. But this is next Saturday in Washington, D.C. Attend if you're in the D.C. area. I know we have folks who are down to travel to support Dr. Welsing's legacy. Check it out. And same thing, if you attend, let us know what you heard and what kind of information and just what your thoughts, observations were on the ceremony next weekend. Wish that I could be there in attendance, but I definitely know it will be fantastic. Next, from this past Thursday's Workplace Racism broadcast, which again is every Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. This past Thursday, I forgot, one of our listeners, she tweeted me as we were on the air and I saw it. I just forgot to include it before we went off air. She said, "I wanted to share that I've been dealing with my overseer, manager, lording over or seeking attention, but after a few weeks, I've been able to avoid him by many strategies. I only interact with him except during our supervision. Perhaps now that I've been able to include the commentary, if you could share for this coming Thursday some of the strategies that you have employed to minimize strife, conflict between you and this white manager overseer, maybe you could share, because other folks have too noted that that has been a problem for them. So if you could share any details on what you've been able to do to kind of minimize direct contact as much as possible, except when you all have to have meetings or what have you, that would be great. And again, Thursday, Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Moving forward, for this program, each compensatory call-in, I request listeners, if people could not use metaphors. It's just consistent within the system of racism, white supremacy. Racists, they will use metaphors to confuse non-white people. That's one of the means of practicing deception. They will make or employ similes, analogies, metaphors, any type of comparison. But the two things that are being compared are not equivalent. This is consistent. They do this sort of thing all the time. It's a deliberate act of racism. Non-white people, victims, we pick up a lot of their habits. And two, most of us, myself at the top of the weather, I even do it myself. Most of us, non-white people, a lot of times we're still learning. We're still attempting to conclude, come to conclusions in terms of what we think should be done. Even, you know, our ideas, our concepts, we're still thinking, we're still learning. So sometimes we just have difficulties choosing our words to articulate our thoughts. And sometimes myself also, you just grab a cliche or a metaphor. You pick one of these phrases or what have you to express your ideas. Frequently, it does not accurately convey what it is that you want to say or what we want to say. A lot of times it just causes confusion. If we can really make an effort to be direct, simple, precise, clear, right to the point about what it is we are trying to say, that would really be appreciated. And I will prompt about that. Thank you kindly. If we could take 5 minutes to share whatever thoughts, views you want to articulate, really appreciate that. That makes sure everybody gets an opportunity to share their thoughts or views. We should have time once everybody gets one opportunity to share their thoughts. We should have time if you have additional comments or questions, anything else that you want to make sure you say. We should have time. So just take your five. I'll watch about time as well. And if you know you are in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be really appreciated. No speakerphone, please, as well, because that just tends to add a lot of distortion. Mute button, say whatever you need. And then if you could mute your line, that would be great. And then we can open. You can unmute yourself if you have other things that you want to say or questions you need to get in. With that, the only other thing I will share, I will leave any commentary about the audio clips and what have you. I will leave that to you all to dissect. The one thing that I will share, I have, I think, made a comment here or there about how difficult the weather has been in Seattle this past year, and it has been massively unpleasant. I do not like cold weather anyway, and it has been historically cold in the Seattle area really since December, and I feel like I have done a pretty good job not griping and complaining about how just it has been grueling the past 3 months with the winter. But I saw there was a news report where they had data to support how gruesome the past 3 months have been in the Pacific Northwest. So just to share what Gus T. Renegade has endured over the past, since December, they said winter's grip has been unusually resilient this year. The anecdotal evidence abounds. You've seen the headlines. For the first time in 48 years, Seattle outsnows Minneapolis in January and February. From the Associated Press, we learned that the Northwest's cool winter held the nation back from setting the distinguished mark of warmest February on record. The months of December through February were the coldest here since 1985. Coldest winter in 32 years is pretty significant in and of itself. For a lot of younger people, it's the coldest winter in their lifetime, said National Weather Service meteorologist Logan Johnson. Incidentally, Gus T., I was not born in this area, so this is the coldest winter I have experienced, period, in the time that I have been in the Seattle area. And then there's snow, which has followed us into March. As far as snowfall goes, you're talking about almost 10 years since we had that much snowfall for the Seattle area. Data bolsters the argument. There's an index to calculate winter's misery called the Accumulated Winter Season Severity Index. The AWSI index qualifies snowfall and temperature measure for an area and then compares a compiled score to previous years. It's our roughest winter since 2008-2009, which is when the cows began. According to the index's data for Seattle, this is a severe winter, said Steve Hilberg at the Midwestern Regional Climate Center, one of two climatologists who created the AWSI measure. I'm just skipping some of the parts that are not really related to Seattle's weather. Okay, here we go. The months of December through February rank as the 36th rainiest winter since the same months in 19... Excuse me. Let me start this all over. The months of December through February rank as the 36th rainiest winter since the same months in 1894 through 1895. With nearly 17 inches of rain, we've more than 2 inches above our average. February was particularly soggy as we nearly set a rain record. Juxtaposing that, from December to February, our skies have been cloudy more than 75% of the time, according to the analysis of National Weather Service sky cover data. For those tiring of winter, it continues to roll on. Stopping there, but metrics, I feel like, too, some of this is codification, as opposed to just saying, man, it's raining cats and dogs outside metaphor, as opposed to that you have actual data to codify. This is how bad the winter has been. And I mean, oh, it has been absolutely miserable every day. I particularly despise cold weather, but spring is nigh, so they tell me. That said, we will get to our callers. I hope it is warmer where you are. 641-715-3640. And the code again is 564-943-pound. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, your line should be open, or at least the first few people who dialed in with a hand up, your line should be open. Feel free.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, hi. Good evening, everyone. Thank you for taking my call. Good clips. I wanted to talk a little bit about the HBCU clip and how the former president has given more. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but historically black colleges and universities are not just for black people. So when they say they gave money to these schools, it's not like they're just giving money to black people. I don't think they're going to just specifically say, oh, this is money we're giving to black people. And also with the increase in the Pell Grant, I think there was also a decrease in the PLUS loans, so parents weren't able to help their students go to college as well. So that could be a mixed bag. Sorry about your weather. I don't live there. I moved south on purpose. And I saw yesterday it seemed a very important bill that they're trying to pass federally about employees being able to take your DNA through, it's called, let me see, I think I had it up. I forgot. It was like the Employee Wellness Act, I guess, in the first passage of the quote-unquote Obamacare. There were employee wellness provisions that if you, like, lost weight or stopped smoking or something, you can get a break in your premium. And now they're trying to pass a law saying that if you don't let them swap your DNA, that you will have to pay more. I think that'll have a lot of negative effects for Black people or just all minorities in general. And if you're able to contact your congressman or senator to make sure that doesn't get passed. That's it for now. If I think of something else, I'll let you know. Thank you.
Very important data for workplace racism. I do encourage listeners to be mindful of that word, minorities, referring to non-white people as minorities. The individuals classified as white, they are the authentic minorities on the planet. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you have a hand up, feel free. Yes, ma'am.
I can wait. Go ahead. I think I heard someone. Can you go ahead? Okay. I'll proceed. Greetings, everybody.
Your volume.
Pardon me.
There you go.
Is
much
this better?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. I'm trying to really multitask and drive. But anyway, I'm sorry that the weather is so terrible for you guys. Thank you for still being committed to the cows, though. And showing up despite. I wanted to say something that kind of, it was like an aha moment for me, similar to when I discovered I didn't have a definition for racism, and when I discovered that to be Black means to be a nigger and it means to not be human or to be subhuman, is that all around the world, everybody is saying, at least it's not like the U.S. And that got me thinking, I'm in the U.S. I'm in the place where everyone else says, at least it's not that bad. And I don't know, that kind of just made me feel very weird, for lack of a better term, that around the world people say, well, at least you're not in the United States, or it's not as bad as it is there. Wow. One second here. We talked about this during the reading, that whites used to get off or have some type of like sexual experience reading slave narratives or hearing about slavery. I feel like that's true. I can hear it even in some of the clips now, that white people just really enjoy talking to us about our suffering and learning, like seeing the ramifications of their system and how it bears on us and how we're figuring it out. They just revel in that. And it reminds me of the episode of Black Mirror called White Bear. They just really enjoy that. I think the clip about the student who, the video that's going viral about the student, I'm still a little bit, well, not even, counter violence, it is what it is. Like, that's more historical than, it, right alongside civilization, you know. If someone is coming at you, fighting you, then you get to protect yourself. Like, that's a natural instinct. And I do consider terrorism, even if it's verbal, being attacking. At first, I was wondering what was really going on, but when the parent said that the student had been telling the teacher several times and the teacher did nothing, I think that really should be highlighted in the story a little bit more than the students fighting, is that, like, how many Black students are doing the correct thing, informing the supervisor or the person above of what's going on, and that person not doing anything, and then when it becomes too much and unbearable, that student reacts, whether it's to fight the other person or engage in some other kind of bullying tactic or even commit suicide, which leads me into the next segment that we listened to. I mean, the system does that all over. He took his life after being incarcerated for 3 years and spent a considerable amount of time in solitary confinement. And at the same time, the levels that Black youth are taking their lives or committing suicide is a really, really high and increasing. And I'm not so sure folks talk about that a lot. You don't even have to be jailed or come from foster care for that to happen. A lot of Black so-called middle class kids are killing themselves, too. And it's just, their system is so effective. And it was so sad to listen. And it reminded me that animals get treated better than we do. And white people look at us as just very well-trained animals. That's it. The clip about the rural areas in Alabama not having proper sewage, I think is very interesting, because a lot of times in the States, folks will talk about so-called third world, that's so-called quote-unquote third world, and about how they lack these fresh water, how they lack sewage, and all this kind of stuff, and that's here. And I remember many years ago, I made the argument that there's a so-called third world America, but nobody is really paying attention. And then a professor tried to spin it like it was third world because some folks didn't have access to the like most advanced technologies. But that's not what I meant. I meant literally like this. And I think it's also interesting because when you apply to, say, like Teach for America or any kind of thing like that, they're not mentioning these areas in Alabama that are primarily or predominantly black who are lacking all of these resources. They're talking about white people in the Appalachian Mountains who don't have these things, but they're never talking about the black people who don't. They act like the only black people who are suffering are ghettoized urban black people, and that's not true. I'll say this really quickly. I'm all for guns. I say it's a Second Amendment right. That's what it means to be American, to be able to do that. I just want to put that out there just because I don't know how many, you know, women really talk about it or black females really talk about it. But I say go to the gun range, get a gun, and you can even just practice with a BB gun. Like, they're awesome. They're really inexpensive at Walmart to get. And you can get guns at Walmart. I mean, you can get better guns for cheaper somewhere else, but you can also get them from Walmart. And then the last thing I wanted to say is, I'm not about the conflict between black actors about where the actors should come from. The one thing about that I think is striking, however, is that when you're an so-called American black, you're the worst kind of black. And I think I don't know if that's what Samuel Jackson was alluding to, but that's what I've come to understand, that black from any other place is better than black here. So, and I never watched Selma, and I didn't know that. You know, I didn't know that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was portrayed by a British actor. I mean, wow, you know? And there's so many black people here who want to be famous and who want to act and who want to do all that stuff. It's amazing. It's like an untapped resource. So I don't even think that it's that the British actors you can get them for less money, because there are a lot of amateur actors here who are talented and fantastic and would excel in those opportunities. I just think that black people here feel like black people in the other parts of the world are better, more smart, or better trained. And I think that black people outside of the United States feel that same way, too. Like, we're the bastardized of black people. Thank you for taking my call, and I'll mute myself. Thanks.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello. Hello, everyone. I think four quick things. I definitely appreciate Emmy, especially for our explanation of, you know, if you're black, then you're not human. If you're not human, or if you're black, you're nigger, then you're not human, because I actually think about that often. The first two things that I've been thinking about, especially with the show, how this is always said, you know, we really should not minimize white women's role within racism. And I've had a few instances with white women. I was able to call in on Thursday with the racism, the workplace and the racism, I'm sorry, racism in the workplace. My friend that I've spoken about before, who had the white people who were stealing a bunch of merchandise that amounted to tens of thousands of dollars. Well, apparently, he has more than just male, white terrorists at his job. He had told me one day at the job, there was this white female who apparently, or sorry, white woman who apparently is with a non-white male. I think he said she is with a black male. And for whatever reason, she felt it comfortable to tell him that her boyfriend, quote unquote, allows her to call black people dumb niggers if she feels like they're doing something incorrect, whether that's on TV or maybe they might be out. Now, I don't know if that also, if that goes as far as her actually calling the black person that to their face, or if they're just like watching the news. And of course, we all know how the news, they like to just display black crimes committed by black people and not by other people. So I don't know if it just like, just only meant to go that, for that way. And so it really just made me think about how, in my opinion, and I could be wrong, how it seems like white women's role within the system of white supremacy seems like they are here to decrease our victimhood and to increase our tolerance of racism. So if we're treated wrong, I felt like with the story that he told me, if we're treated wrong, then it's our fault because I'm assuming in her words, we're acting like a bunch of dumb niggers anyway. The other story that I had, I was actually getting some food. I had pulled into a parking lot and I was waiting for the business to open up because it's usually pretty busy. And I pulled into a parking spot, and this white woman, I guess she felt like I pulled in too close to her car, and she kind of stared me down. And I remember when Roz was telling this story a while back, and I can't remember which type of show it was on, but he was talking about how a white person was staring him down. I think it might have been like in the subway, and he stared them down right back, and they averted their eyes. And so that's basically what I did. And she did the same thing, but also she added like a smile to it, but she made me feel like, you know, almost a condescending way to try to look down upon me as if I got too close to her car. So it didn't end there. I actually had to get in line behind her, and she was talking to another suspected racist. And the woman had to have worked for the school system. And she was talking about how the children, they're all out of control. And to me, it kind of made it seem like, you know, basically her being codified saying, the non-white children are out of control, and the poor teachers, they're being abused by these children, and you should have saw how the child was treating the teacher and abusing the teacher verbally and physically. And, of course, her white companion, another female, was agreeing with the whole thing. And the one thing that really struck me was that the white woman said, if it was me, and I kind of felt like she might have been like a janitor or maybe a teacher's aide, not necessarily a teacher. She said, if it was me, I would have taken the child off into a private room and talked to them. And I don't feel like it would have just been talking. And so it definitely affected me tremendously. And I just didn't know what to say. And even if I would have said something, I felt like what difference would it have made? But I felt like I've noticed throughout, you know, whenever I go somewhere, but I don't want to say whenever, but there have been numerous times where I've gone to different places and whites, they talk amongst each other and loud enough for other people to hear, especially if we're in line, where they basically are just sharing racist stories. And that just brought me to the other point that I was thinking about how it's their job to also increase our tolerance of their racist acts or them practicing racism. The last thing, it kind of with the clip about Samuel L. Jackson talking about how British black actors seem to get more work, or even non-American black actors seem to get more work than black actors born in America. It just made me think about how, once again, racists are doing a great job with causing black people to be angry with one another instead of actually focusing on the real problem, as we talk about all the time, racism, white supremacy. White people could hire more black American actors. They just choose not to. And so, and it also made me think about another issue at my job where they're not training black people. And if I have to go back in and train these other black associates, I try to not be so mad at them because I know it's not necessarily their fault. This is their job. This is what they are trying to do. They're trying to cause conflict between us. So that's all I had. Thank you for allowing me to share.
For sure. I just wanted to get in really quick. Samuel L. Jackson, did a phenomenal job. I think some of these comments were on Hot 97 from this past week, so you can hear exactly what he had to say. But he said specifically, after this became a big deal, you can look on CBS SF Bay Area. Samuel L. Jackson says he criticized the system, not black British actors. And he goes into detail about this. He says specifically, it was not a slam against them, but it was just a comment about how Hollywood works in an interesting way sometimes. And he goes on to say that he does not have a problem with black British actors, and that it is the system, i.e. white people, that are to blame, culpable, for who does the hiring in all of this, which I thought was really important. Who is responsible for this problem? White people. Other folks that we have not heard from, did you have commentary? Should be with us.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. I'll just report on three incidents in order to stay within the time frame. Starting out earlier this week, which most of us at some point in time have a visit to the grocery store, and specifically in line. A lot of times I have the feeling that the person that's behind me in the cashier's line is in some sort of a hurry. And most likely when I look behind me, that person is a white female or appears to be a white female. But some of the traits that goes on, you kind of like feel that their grocery carriage is kind of like more closer than it needs to be to you as you are moving it through the line to conduct your business. And I experienced that this week, to whereas this person, which would be considered down here in South Florida, well, you know, the weather gusts is like constantly in the 70s or something like that, sometimes in the 80s, and it's been that way almost all this year. But anyway, back to the story. I was at the little machine where you swipe your card and whatnot, and she seemed to be in so much of a hurry that I couldn't even get away from the machine before she's sticking her card in the machine. So that prompted me to turn around and ask her, are you in a hurry? And she said, yeah, I'm in a hurry. I said, well, you need to go to the line, the 10 or less products line, where people in a hurry are supposed to be at. And I looked down and her card was in that machine. And something in my mind told me to snatch her card out the machine and throw it as far as I can. Then she really would be delayed. But it reminds me of Mr. Fuller's codification to be careful about being involved with something of a problem and you cause more problems that could potentially come to yourself. And I controlled my temper, as I mentioned before in this program. I controlled it very quickly after having that flash thought, and just described to her loud enough and right in her face that she can hear it, as far as the description of what I thought she was behaving as, and kept it moving. In other words, I called her a-hole and kept it moving. As far as that concerned. Next situation, read a article, and it's unfortunately it's atypical, I would say perhaps around the world. This particular article started off with a picture of a quote unquote jogging club. all white people that was in the middle of a quote-unquote area where black people are allowed to stay at. They were taking a selfie. It said in the picture that it was two black people in this picture that was way in the back, but I never did recognize them in the picture. But nevertheless, and the article itself was talking about what is typically called gentrification. And I agree with Mr. Fuller by calling it misplacement, non-white misplacement. Saying the typical situations that goes on in the deceitful justifications that white people have into what they do and how they go about the way of doing it, acting surprised when the non-white black people show a verbal and or literal level of disgust in their behavior, and that sort of thing. I just thought it was interesting. I would read it, but it would take up too much time. I think everybody have just about experienced or read that somewhere. It's also in the area where I grew up at. I can stand out in front of my mother's home and literally never see a black person in a car driving down the street. And that area was designated by a white person for non-white black males who were veterans and their families. But that is very quickly changing. Moving on today, something more joyful, I put it that way. At the mentoring program session today, walked in and I saw a non-white black male by the name of Lonnie Lawrence. He's well known down here as he was a spokesperson for Metro-Dade Police Department back in the late 70s, early 80s, and had been in law enforcement for a very long time. He was actually one of the speakers to the young black males, basically about safety and correct behavior when confronted by law enforcement. After his session, I've never met him personally, and he started to say his name, and I told him, I know who you are every time. And you probably have seen him also, Gus, but I think I've heard you say you've watched the series on Eyes on the Prize. On this segment talking about the 1980 McDuffie riots, he was one of the primary people that was interviewed in that segment of the Eyes on the Prize, where he was talking about his friend, Arthur McDuffie, which was the unfortunate, in my mind, murder victim that was the cause of that particular riot in 1980. And I basically expressed to him that although he was a spokesperson for Metro-Dade Police Department, it also gave the viewer an idea that he was also speaking for non-white black people too, as far as his way of representing himself by being a product of the community himself. And so that basically was my week in racism, white supremacy. Thank you.
Appreciate that. If we have other folks that we have not heard from, if you have commentary, feel free.
Good evening, everyone. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I'd just like to share a couple of things that I've experienced this past week. It just never ceases to amaze me. It doesn't amaze me anymore, but the access that white people have to everyone on the planet, any place, to all the other, you know, non-white people. They just have access to any areas. So I'm riding in the shuttle bus or shuttle van, you know, going to a place, and it's just me and the white driver, a white male driver. He's maybe in his 50s, I'm thinking, and, you know, having conversation, which I would rather not talk at all. I would sit there in silence and be just fine. But, you know, he's initiating conversation. And I'm trying to be courteous. Didn't have any headphones at the time, but, you know, I don't know how we got on the subject. We were just talking about traveling to different places, and he was speaking on that he was recently on a Native American or Indian reservation, and he was just speaking as to how poor the people were and how much it was in, I guess, just in a bad sad conditions or just bad conditions. And he was like, well, yeah, just being on this, going to this reservation, it's really, man, it's really tough going there. And I was like, okay, why do you say this, sir? And he's like, yeah, it's not a place for a white man. And so basically I gathered that he's saying that the police, the Native American police are more, I guess, vigilant against white people, supposedly. So I just thought that was very interesting what he said about that. I have a person that I do consider a friend. He's a black male, but he is in a tragic arrangement. And I take that into consideration when I'm dealing with him or interacting with him. But he invited me somewhere, and I was, I guess I knew after I accepted the invitation, I knew there was really some place where I shouldn't even go. It wasn't like a bar or anything. It was a presentation from the local firefighters in the area. And it was for St. Patrick's Day. And I live in an area that's predominantly just a high population of white people, high concentration and population of white people. So I go to this presentation, they're talking about the Irish and the history of the Irish, and how they were discriminated against, you know, when they immigrated to, you know, the United States, and how they had it so tough. They had to work all the jobs that were, you know, the jobs that other people want. And it was just amazing to me. Like, and I know we've on the cows, I think the author of a book of how the Irish became white, you know, of course they weren't considered white at some point, but it's like you would listen to that presentation that they had and you would think that they're still the victims today. And it's just amazing how white people can always turn it around and just make themselves victims all the time or whatever. So, and then they'll try to say, hey, you know, black people, you weren't the only ones that were being abused and being terrorized. We were too, but you're participating in it now. And for many years, you've been terrorizing black people. And of course, every last one of the firefighters, they kind of introduced all the firefighters, and you know, they've been on a job anywhere from 5 years to 30, 40, 50 years. And every last one of them was, you know, white. And it was just, I wish I could just say something as far as, hey, why is it all white people in this, this organization? Like, but anyway, and lastly, black people, specifically black people, have no credibility when it comes to dealing with white people. I'm dealing with a property manager, and just talking, and we're talking about, you know, I'm terminating my vacating my residence. And I'm talking to a lady, and I'm telling her that, hey, I turned in my termination letter to terminate my lease. And she just, it's a white lady, of course, and she just says, no, we don't have that. And I said, yes, you do have that. It's like I had to repeat this like 6-7 times to her. And then finally she goes and talks to another white lady in the office and then says, oh, okay, yeah, we have your termination letter. But you just told me that I didn't turn it in like 4 or 5 times. And she's over talking me and I'm talking to her. And it's like a lot of these white women, they're very, I notice this program talks about it a lot, but these white women are very bold. They're very bold. Like, I don't know. And they claim to be so scared of us and so frightened, but they're very bold when it comes to that. And they know what they're doing. They want to stress you out and then call you the angry, you know, wild nigger, really, if you get angry and then lash out at them. So it was just very interesting week for me. But thanks for letting me share.
Wowie. One of our listeners wrote in. Appreciate you sharing that as well. One of our listeners wrote in. She said that her son, black male, he watched a debate featuring James Baldwin. Her son came to the conclusion, and I quote, "This debate makes me think, do white people invite blacks to debate and talk just to learn better strategies to harm us?" Question. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you have commentary you would like to share, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello to all the callers on the line. This is Kendra. From the first report, what stood out to me was when the reporter made it seem as if whites, including herself, back to white women again, do not realize when they are practicing racism. Black self-respect to Desmond Cole, you know, he took her right out of her lies, causing her to be, you know, a little more truthful when she acknowledged maybe we do, which to me meant practicing racism. Maybe we do know when we are practicing racism is really what I took out of that. And then she chuckled afterwards, which stood out to me as well, which in my estimation, basically, she's saying, you know, I know my power in this system and what. Also, the tackiness of her thanking Desmond for making us think. I think she said something about, thank you, Mr. Cole, for making us think, as if Desmond Cole just stated something she wasn't fully aware of. Lastly, I think it's very interesting that gun sales dropped among whites since Trump's election, which was the opposite during President Obama's election. But it's the reverse with non-white blacks, which isn't surprising, you know, with the more overt climate we are currently in. To the last gentleman who just spoke, a few seconds ago, I think he was talking about his property manager. I recently started investing in real estate and got myself an investment property and joined a real estate organization. And he's very, very much correct. The white women in the organization that I'm in, and these are women who have like a lot of properties. We're not talking one or two. They're not beginners. These are women with 20, 30 properties. And just to hear them talk, and I've learned just so much about how they practice racism, you know, and the way they rent to people of color, what they say, what they don't say, how they, you know, avoid renting to people of color, and where there's, you know, it can't come back to them that they are practicing racism. So it's been very, very eye-opening, and I have a better understanding now of, how it's so challenging for people of color to, you know, get property, because I see the mechanisms that's, you know, been placed to make it very, very difficult, even in something as just renting, it's not easy. And I'm very much aware of the obstacles that's placed. So thank you very much, Gus. I appreciate the opportunity to speak.
Congrats with your real estate investing. make a fortune. Any other folks that we have not heard from at all have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings to you, the hosts, the callers, and the listeners. I just wanted to say thank you to Mr. Kinsfield for his comments and a number of other people who have commented. I think that everybody does a really good job on this show. I've mentioned before that I think the show is the most productive programming that I'm hearing currently. And one thing I would want to say is I think that the problem has already been solved. I mean, not necessarily. We still have the problem here, but I think that the problem has been solved as far as the equation. It's been solved several times before, I think it's been solved on this show. I think it's other people have solved the problem. I think that what we have to do is just amplify the solution. And I say that, with music, I notice sometimes when you hit a certain note, it'll make something vibrate in the room. But then I know if you amplify that particular vibration, whatever that frequency is, if you amplify that frequency, eventually you can break an object. And I think that we can, I don't want to use a metaphor, but I think it's the same thing. I think that we can send certain frequencies to the problem. And if we are amplifying the correct frequency, then eventually we'll solve the problem. I mean, eventually completely solve the problem. Other thing I wanted to say is I was watching this TV show earlier in the week. And I forgot what it's called, but it shows an America where everybody is, a bunch of places are split up and divided. Philadelphia has its own territory. Atlanta has its own territory. Then other places has its own territory. And at one point, I guess the electricity's out. The white people turned on the electricity. White woman, led by a white woman. And she blows up, or I guess, another guy blows up, but because of her, they blow up Atlanta and they blow up Philadelphia. And these are predominantly black places. And like, I guess everybody within a 30-mile radius died. Now, I just say that it reminded me of the Planet of the Apes, you know, after they figure whatever, you know, America goes to be starting to get divided, they'll try to destroy massive numbers of black people. And I just would say we should be prepared for that. And we should take every opportunity to oppose white people in everything that we do. I think that we should tell them not to reproduce. White people should not reproduce. That'll be the last thing I say. Thank you.
He had an admitted racist. Said that too. He said definitely white people should not be having sex with non-white people, and they should not have sex with other white people until they figure out how to stop practicing racism. He was obviously not willing to make that commitment himself. Other folks that we have not heard from, any other people that we've not heard from at all, have commentary. Yes, ma'am. Are you there, ma'am? We heard you. Are you there, ma'am?
Oh, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. This is the caller from Florida. I know it's been a while since I called in, and just been busy getting back onto the plantation here in Florida, because I had went through and getting my transfer from my job, and I work out in Ocala at a location out there, And, well, I'm from Florida, so to be expected, you know, what I would encounter out there. But nonetheless, it seems like the topic throughout the past week, nonetheless, has been centered around the role of the white female. And I've just come to the conclusion that they are the administrators and, you know, secretaries of the system. White men are like, I guess you're the strong arm of white supremacy, but the role of the white female by far is to help maintain and refine and to teach and to pass on, you know, the information of how to maintain the system for the next generation, because just seeing how they operate in, you know, in the workplace alone. And as we know, they're the main ones that have benefited from things like affirmative action and various other programs. You know, they're doing a very good job. I haven't been able to call into the workplace racism just simply because my scheduling between work and physical therapy. And so I just be, I'm just very tired after the week. But nonetheless, if it's all right, could I just share with you my first day of white females' aggression towards me, my first day, Gus?
Let's hear it.
Okay. Well, this was an older white female. I had cornrows. I reported to work my first day, and I was doing my work, minding my business, and she comes out of nowhere asking me, tell me, how much of that is really your hair? Don't know her, don't know anybody, I just, you know, whatever. I was just like, well, I would say about 35%. And so she was like, okay. She was like, yeah, I have mixed grandchildren, and, you know, their hair tends to be a lot looser. I said, well, I'm sorry. I just pretty much let her speak. She went on a great deal talking about the, I guess, their texture of hair and the coloring, and went into talking about their skin and all this other stuff. And like I said, I never had a conversation with her, nothing like that. And then she walked off to the back, somewhere to the break room, and I guess it kind of dawned on her because of the way I was looking. And she came back and she said, I forgot where I was going with that one. And I said, And so she tried to talk to me a little bit more, but by then I was just like, let me try and get away from her. So as she started to talk more about my hair, I finally just went on ahead and said, well, majority of black people, you know, I talked to her about protective styles and stuff. I don't know. You can't educate them on things like that. This is stuff that they know. And the fact that she says that she has grandchildren that are, I hate the word mixed race. It sounds like you're talking about some Chiweenie type animal. I don't know. But nonetheless, a lot of them, especially at this location, I guess they're what you would consider veterans. They've been in their positions for 10 plus years. the company is going through a lot of changes, and, you know, they're getting ready to go through another merger. And so they tend to be very territorial over their positions, even though they've already been demoted because of all this stuff going on within the company. And for whatever reason, you know, I was told my first day by another person in my same position. Again, she came while she was off the clock to scope me out, I guess. And I was in the office. She comes in, starts talking to me about, you know, how the store manager is and how he is about overtime. You know, I don't even know who this person is. She never introduced herself to me. Almost as if to, you know, we're going to let this nigger know what we're about here in Ocala type of attitude. So I've been met with all of that throughout the week until I finally had to say something to my store manager, and we had a discussion. You know, I basically just let him know where I stood with some things, you know, as far as what I'm not gonna deal with, especially when I have another associate that's we're all part of management, so I don't see, you know, everybody is trying to be a manager. So I just asked them, well, who is the managers here? Because just seems like everybody is graveling to be a manager, and we need to establish some definitive lines of authority in the office, because they lost an assistant store manager, then they lost another manager like me, or what they would consider a shift lead, because of the same person that I'm having issues with, the one who was asking me about my hair. So he's been running the office without an assistant store manager for some time now. And, you know, so finally, just yesterday, the district manager had came in, and basically they tried to lie and say that, oh, well, we was going to have you as a floater, when that never was discussed or the case. And it finally came out. He asked me, eventually, the district manager, that there had been a corporate complaint and this, that, and other that was placed against the store. So I'm looking at him like, so are you actually telling me that I didn't put the complaint in, by the way. I know who did. I know several people who did. But again, this is me being codified and trying to keep myself in a neutral position. I've been addressing whatever issues I've had since I've been there directly to the store manager. So there was never any intention or need for me to speak to anybody from corporate. I pretty much overall, this location is nothing like what I had to deal with in New Orleans.
Hang on one second, Princess. I just want to make sure we don't miss anybody. You can wrap up the remainder of what happened when they get all these folks involved and make the accusation, and if the white woman did some more dastardly or tacky things with you or your hair situation. But just let me make sure we don't miss anybody, and then you can give us the second half. It'll make sure folks stay tuned so they can hear how it concludes. That we missed completely, anybody who has not shared at all, have commentary that they wanted to share?
Bobby Hurt?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Gus, I see you got a new white woman now, huh? I call in and the whole voice changed. You know, it's a new white woman directing you to Dallas. Press star 6. Press 1, you know. Very interesting how they keep using the white woman's voice for all these things. Like, that soothes us. Had a few comments. Well, first, I just wanted the Khalif Browder story, I watched it. It was quite compelling. And the weirdest thing happened that day. Because, you know, I got out of work. I worked a double that day. And I got home, and my wife was coming in late because she had to go to a play. And, you know, I was rushing home to get the kids ready for school, and it was kind of late, and I decided you know, let's just order a pizza, you know, instead of having to cook. So that's what we did. And, you know, I guess you could call it bad timing or lack timing, but I walk out the door, and I live in, you know, in New York and Harlem. Six buildings that were six separate buildings, but they were all vacant, you know, and they connected them all together so you could walk through all six and utilize the elevators and everything. So there's two entrances really to my building. So I left the back entrance, and before I could get to the front entrance, and the pizza place is right on the corner, I see the police roll up and they hop out the car and they, you know, immediately jump out and say I fit the description of a crime that was committed around the corner. And, you know, I'm saying, listen, you know, I still have my uniform on, you know, like I just came home from work, going to the corner, had the money in my hands. So they say, yeah, we understand, sir. You know, we can see that, but, you know, you fit the description and we just need to, and just as they're talking, they say, hold on. And of course, the walkie-talkie, you hear the description go out, you know, black male, black hoodie. I had on a black hoodie, puffy coat, which wasn't a hoodie, blue jeans. I had on blue icky work pants, so that wasn't jeans, you know, 5'6", 140, 150 pounds. I'm 6'5", 300 pounds. So I'm like, well, they, you know, listen, that's obviously not me, you know, so they're like, oh, no, no, wait up, we got to go through the procedures. Like, well, what kind of procedures could you have? The description doesn't meet me, fit me. So they call on the walkie-talkie to their sergeant who says he's going to come around and take a look. And it's like, come on, man, I'm in front of my building. You know, let me just go do what I have to do. This isn't me. You know it's not me. Then the picture comes across the phone. So they both look at the picture. As they look at it, I look at it too. It's, I know the guy. It's not me. You know, this guy is half my size, man. You know, so they're like, yeah, it's definitely not this guy. The sergeant's still like, listen, you know, I got to come around and check. So the sergeant comes around, and he just rides past. And he says, yeah, it doesn't look like the description, but hold him for a few more seconds. And then another two cop cars pull up, and then these guys come out. Like, hey, buddy, let me see your ID. And, you know, I'm like, why do you want to see my ID? This isn't me. The picture's on the phone. The description doesn't meet me. You know, oh, this is just procedure, you know. So either way, I pull out my phone and I call my wife. And she comes out the building now. And, you know, angry black woman, you know, how they, you know, what the F is going on here? He just walked out the door, you know, and, oh, calm down, ma'am. You know, we're sorry. It's just procedure. But either way, they say, just let him go, you know. And it was like, you acting like you're doing me a favor. So you go look for the person that committed the crime instead of harass people that's walking down the street. So I tell her to go in the house. I walk to get the pizza. As I'm getting the pizza, she comes into the pizza place because I think that they want to search you now, and they also want to, you know, run your ID because that's what the guy's telling them to do, the sergeant. So I said, man. So I walk back, you know, we walk back together around the corner, and they're still in front of my building. And they say, sir, give me your ID, please, you know, just so we can fill out our paperwork. And I already know that after you do that, then they can say, hey, you mind if we just, sir, you know. I said, listen, am I being, I went back to the cow show, am I being detained or am I free to go? Oh, sir, you're free to go. All right, let's go, baby. And we walk right in the building. So the older cop said, oh, F them. Just write on the report that they refuse. Like, we now, mind you, if someone stabbed and bleeding, and there's five cop cars in front of my building, and I'm not the person who did it, it's already been established. They're not looking for the person who did it. It's just, you know, just how the system works. So right after that, I go in and I watch the police Crowder story. And you see how fast someone can get caught up. Especially in New York City, and it just gets swept under the rug. Just one of, you know, 8.5 million people's story. You know, I appreciate that the content of the show, as opposed to, you know, Barbershop or Friday or Power, Jay-Z, in my opinion, he did a very good job at picking this type of this type of subject and topic to talk about, as opposed to the things that, unfortunately, the rappers usually, when they make movies, they make it very silly or it's very street. And this was very real, very realistic. And I think that it should wake a lot of people up as to what happens. Not to mind you, you know, that I think that what it did more than anything was to show how someone can not only break, but they can get pushed to their breaking point. You know, here comes someone, and I'm not going to get bullied anymore. I'm not going to get pushed around anymore. I'm going to fight back. And then you get rewarded for fighting back by doing 800 days of your 3 years in solitary. I mean, it's only 1,100 days in 3 years. 800 of them he spent in solitary confinement, in which they said creates a mental illness after, I believe it was 45 days. I mean, you're banging your head on the wall. You don't have no one to talk to. You don't created a whole world. People were covering themselves in feces. People were banging their heads on the wall and bleeding nonstop. That would cause anyone to break. And when you hit that breaking point, I just see in the psych ward here in the hospital, having to go there and clean and have to deal with the patients as they're walking around and kind of protect myself and kind of seeing how they act. I would love to know how many of these people ever were in solitary confinement before. Were they ever arrested and put into a solitary confined type or put into a psych ward where they were confined only to themselves to make their mental illness worse or to create the mental illness altogether? There's a few clips. I know I took up a lot of time. I just wanted to say the clip where the guy, I believe he was a cop, and they were in Hillside, New Jersey. Was that Hillside, New Jersey, Gus?
I believe so.
Yeah. I remember when they started to let blacks move to Hillside, New Jersey. This was in the late 80s, early 90s. And Hillside, New Jersey. I mean, I remember people leaving Jersey City like, oh, we moved on up. We moving to Hillside. You know, people were leaving Newark saying the same thing. And I just want to say Hillside today looks like Jersey City and Newark. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
It was Hillside, New Jersey. Any other folks that we have not heard from? Any other folks that we have not heard from have commentary? Good job. That is the question to ask. You can stop by enforcement officials. Am I free to go? Folks we have not heard from at all?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I just want to point out something really quick from the segment about the young black male who was in the hallway and confronted the suspected racist teenager. And a lot of the white supremacy that manifested, even in the clip, I think the person or the student that took that video, Was it said that's a white student, Gus?
They showed a little bit of the video in the news clip, even though y'all couldn't hear it. So it was a black student did the pulling. The white student was the one saying, you know, black, the racial slurs, I think they said it.
Oh, okay. And I noticed, like, how the teacher pretty much stepped in front of him and was, in my view, as well as the black kid that was in the video was saying, you know, you're protecting him because he's white. I thought that was profound, you know, that even though he was understandably so in a highly emotional mode, he knew that she was pretty much also assisting in the assault of practicing racism. And she was saying, well, you know, at least from what I've heard from the reports, that if you hit a girl and you're a punk and just engaging in name calling and basically saying, you know, well, he used words, but this, as the report said, carried on for weeks or, well, I mean, months. And she did not step in from what the other students were saying and didn't really do anything. So she as well is a guilty party. And I don't think they released her name or as well as the suspected racist student. And most importantly, well, really not most importantly, but I found it interesting that in the clip, they classified him as a football player. Like, you know, when they said when they were protesting, the students were protesting, the person that was doing the report said they don't know when the football player will be able to come back. Like, they didn't call him a student, almost making it seem as though he's not there for his academics or he can't perform well academically. You know, I thought that was an act of racism. And that's all I have for now. Thank you.
Good point about him being identified as an athlete, not a scholar. That's the primary reason. I mean, this is high school. It's not like we're talking about, you know, even college athletics where they say, oh, you know, that's the only reason they're here and they're getting a big scholarship and all that. I thought that's important, too, because that seems to be standard operating procedure with a lot of these incidents. We're talking about something that happens at a school where if it ends up where there's an altercation of some sort, invariably the victim, the non-white person, will say, this is not the first time. There have been other incidents, and I've reported it, and they did nothing. I have heard that over. I mean, it's bunches of clips that we've played here on the compensatory call-in over the past years where you all have heard that over and over again, where the parents come in and we said this. I guess that's one thing where you can do the same thing with workplace racism, where you can have documentation where this is, and you can start training non-white children by the time you're in high school. Write that information down. These are all the students' names, because that's important too, where they don't name the racists. Write down all their names, the teacher's name. This is who I told, and tell your teacher, and then you can go to the main office, tell the principal or the vice principal, anybody else. Let them know, so then you can write down, these are all the people. Parents, same thing you do on the job. Email, I'm addressing this. My child told me that this happened today. What's being done to address this problem? Then, if there does end up being an altercation or suspension or something like that, you can do the same thing we talk about on workplace racism. You whip out all your documentation, emails, letters, all the reports. I think that puts you in a much better position than just saying that this happened before. And writing, when you have things written down, dates, times, all that, I think it gives a much more serious appearance. I think for a lot more people, it strikes them as being, wow, we got to take this a lot more seriously. They have documentation about all of this incident. Other folks that we have not heard from at all have commentary. We got about a half hour left in the program. Anybody that we have missed totally? We got everybody? I will assume we got everybody. Line should be open. If you have commentary that you want to get in, please do not wait until the last moment. Go ahead, speak now. If you have commentary, I think everybody who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. I know Princess, our caller in Florida, she was giving her workplace racism update. You should be able to finish the rest of what was happening on the job. And then we had the female caller that I mentioned at the top of the program, where she wrote in Thursday about her workplace racism experience. Where she was saying she was trying to minimize contact with her race soldier manager, supervisor. The segment that I played about environmental racism in North Carolina and Alabama, she has direct connection to North Carolina. She said, I grew up in Raleigh, North Carolina, and this is disturbing. A friend of mine was part of a team in 2006 of the Greensboro Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The final report is archived at Bennett College for Women. He left the country after this due to threats. The full report can be accessed at greensborotrc.org. I just downloaded the report. It's like 40 pages, not that long to read. But the address again is greensborotrc.org. And you can get the report, download it, and check it out. I will read it over. If the listener who submitted this, I guess if you still have contact with your friend, even though he's out of the country, if he'd be interested in talking about the experience compiling this report and what led him to exit the U.S., would be great to have him on the broadcast if he is so inclined. But thank you for sharing. I'll post the link on Facebook as well. Other folks have commentary before we get Princess to give us the remainder of her workplace racism situation? I assume folks are straight for the moment. Princess, if you want to give us the remainder of what happened on the workplace.
Okay. Well, I'll make it short because I don't want to take up anybody's time. But make a long story short, like I said yesterday, district manager had came in after the store manager had briefly spoken to me about possibly making me a floater for different stores. Like I said, I drive a total of 30 miles away from where I live at in Leesburg to Ocala, which is okay. But to then become a floater, that can be problematic. And that's not what was told to me in the beginning. So they concocted this story of saying that, oh, that's what we intentionally meant to do. And the district manager, strangely enough, was admitting fault for it, although I never met him until my first week. At that point, the same individual who made the comment about my hair and other things had also said that he was a jerk and that he only gives attention to females that are blonde and look pretty and this, that, and the other. She just wanted to let me know that because apparently he had threatened her about her job or something, whatever the case may be. But the point is that he made it clear to me that none of the females here don't like him and he doesn't like them either. And so my thing was, is okay, well, if we have that understanding, if this was already going on, after he asked me whether or not I was the one behind contacting corporate, my thing is, why would you think that I would have to contact anybody? And two, the comment itself is problematic because as an employee in your employee handbook, you as an employee with any organization or company has the right to, you know, contact corporate or, you know, utilize the open door policy. Like I said, from day one, I've been speaking directly to the supervisor as well as having my documentation. And still I'm met with, you know, this false accusation against me. And so I, you know, after giving him great pushback and, letting him know flat out of, you know, no, I didn't do this, didn't need to, because I've been in this office repeatedly speaking to him about ongoing things as well as what people was communicating to me to help me better understand the situation that I was walking into. And like I said, these group of white females are, as he described them, my store manager himself, the one who commented about my hair, he described them as being very aggressive and stuff like that. So again, that's what I'm saying. I think it's in their nature to be, just being white in general, but the females, white females tend to take it up a notch, as well as the fact that they're extremely irrational and emotional. So like I said, you know, it may work out in my favor that if they do wind up putting me as a floater, because then I don't have any ties or commitment to one particular store. My concern as far as, you know, don't jip me with my hours and stuff, but I'll keep everybody posted. But I explained to him the whole thing as far as me accusing me of doing that was totally off base and wrong. And for me, it's problematic because basically, and I said that I felt that I was being retaliated against. So that's when he had brought in the district manager, or the district manager walked in. He wanted to say that it wasn't planned, but I just told them both. I find that hard to believe. But basically, like I said, the fact that he even asked me that, like I said, it makes the case of this is being done out of retaliation against me. And I stated that, and that's when, you know, he was trying to explain to me, no, this was something in the works, and, you know, they only need two shift leads, and then they're going to have the former assistant store manager that herself, she went out on leave for foot surgery. She's coming back on the 14th magically, when I was told clearly that she was coming back and, or she wasn't coming back because she's been gone for so long. So, you know, I don't know. But
that,
anybody have any suggestions? Because like I said, it's like, damn if you do, damn if you don't. I mean, I took my documentation. I didn't blow up. I didn't make a big scene about anything. I just, you know.
That's counter-racism. I do make an effort to try to say that regularly, that the system of racism, white supremacy, to be more accurate, the system of racism, white supremacy, you can do everything correctly. You can say everything correctly. Racist man, racist woman can still choose to practice racism, and unfortunately right now they still have the power to do that, and sometimes it's not a whole lot that you can do about it. Sometimes it's not that you did anything incorrect or you said something incorrectly. They're just practicing racism. With the whole, and it could very well have been just more tackiness, starting out with the hair thing, and then, you know, we'll get her, and, you know, we'll mess her over on the schedule, which whites do all the time. That comes up on workplace racism on a weekly basis. The one thing that I was saying, anytime when there's an accusation that you, did you report such and such to a different person? Did you go to this manager, or did you go to corporate? Did you, you know, report something? And particularly if it's being asked in an accusatory tone, I have to think about it a little bit. And certainly, you know, if you're being asked this sort of question and it's unannounced, right? So they're kind of, you're surprised by the question. It can be difficult to think, you know, how would you answer? How would you respond? And you don't want to put yourself in a position where you're going to be subjected to greater harm. But that's one where I would think about not even answering their question and asking, is that a problem if I did? Or you can phrase it however you want to, but are we not to contact corporate and just have them explain, like, is there something incorrect? So if I had contacted corporate in this case, not saying that I did, but if I had, is that incorrect? Is that something that we are not allowed to do? Is that a violation of my duties, my responsibilities, policy and procedure here? And if so, yeah, let's see that in the policy and procedure manual that, you know, I'm not supposed to, or employees are not supposed to contact corporate or whomever else it is that, you know, if they're asking in an accusatory manner, I suspect that might be the route that I would go. Are we not supposed to? Is there a list of people that we're not supposed to contact? We have a problem. We're only supposed to talk to this one person and no one else, just to make sure I'm clear. And then also, are any other employees being interrogated about whether or not they contacted such and such? Am I the only person that's being questioned about whether or not I did this? If it's equal protection under the law, that's what everything's supposed to happen. Is this, you know, suspicion about all of the employees or just me? And if so, why would that be, that I'd be the only one that'd be suspected of, you know, contacting corporate or whoever this person is? Those are two thoughts that I had. In addition, just again, sometimes you can do everything correctly. Racists are going to be racist.
Yeah, and that's pretty much what I was going to ask, but when he began telling me about, I wanted to ask that, but like we're saying, it's like, damn if you do, damn if you don't, because I didn't want it to be a situation where he was thinking that I'm second-guessing or getting, you know, whatever. Like I said, I was cool as a cucumber because I know I didn't do it. I can't fake it. I didn't call. Like I said, I pretty much know what's going on, but I'm not going to rat any of the other people out simply because, again, it will make it, it will wind up, you know, because I'm the new person coming in. And he said something that was interesting. He was like, well, we normally don't take any transfers or outside people. We're a close-knit family here in Ocala, and we like ours homegrown. And I gave him a look like, did he just say this? But I'm, you know, we're supposed to be seasoned in this kind of racist thing, but I'm just still sometimes amazed at some of the things that come out of white people's mouths. And I guess once I gave him that look, he kind of changed his approach as far as talking to me and was like, well, we don't want you to leave here and this, that, and the other. And I was like, well, I had no idea I was leaving until I walked in this office today. I said, I pretty much was telling him at one point, it really doesn't matter because you're going to do whatever you're going to do, right? And he was like, well, no, we want you to stay here and we're going to think of something else. So in my mind, translation, they're going to find another way to screw me. So I don't know. It's just white people.
Indeed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. Did you have suggestions?
I did, just really quick. I agree with Gus. It doesn't mean that you did anything wrong. Are you documenting? I first have a question. Are you documenting? And then if you're not documenting, I would highly recommend going ahead and writing down as much as you can remember, like listen back to everything you said to us and write it out and all of that so you have it in written form.
Yes, I have it in written form.
Can I be heard?
Spectacular.
Yeah, I adopted that policy from the show and just my time out in New Orleans with all the kerfuffle at the original office that I was at. So, yeah.
Were you done, Emmy? That was your all you wanted to share on that?
Yes. Thank you.
Mr. Steele?
Yeah. In the case where you have accurate documentation, down to if you can write down minutes, you can take all of your evidence to an employment lawyer, and from there you can judge. They can make the determination if you have a case or not. If they are a big enough corporation, they'll have money set aside to settle with people for various complaints. They typically want to have these cases go away as quickly as possible. And if you have documentation of special treatment, special scrutiny, and an employment lawyer does make the determination that you do have a case, they'll usually take that on contingency. So that's contingent that you win any settlement money. They'll take a percentage. So yeah, I would definitely go that route. If you have your evidence together, I would just type into Yelp employment lawyer and find one that has a good rating, submit your evidence there. You know, you can copy and paste into Yelp. And then from there, they will probably call you and have you do a phone screen. And then if they make a determination that your case does meet their threshold for something that can potentially win some money, they will then have the lawyer call you. Or if the case is not so good, they usually have lawyers that are associated with them that will take cases that they determine to be weaker or not as winnable. So you're usually best off seeking professional help at this juncture, and that's my contribution. I'll mute my line.
About the last 10 minutes or so of the broadcast, please do not wait till the last minute if you have a question or a comment that you want to share before the broadcast concludes. Folks have anything else that they wanted to share?
Oh, Gus, the weather was nice here in Florida today, by the way.
Whoopee, whoopee, whoopee. Other commentary folks wanted to get in? Anything that they've heard, audio clips, suggestions they wanted to share before we get ready to wrap things up?
Yeah, Gus, what's the normal weather in Seattle, normally the temperature this time of year?
40, overcast. That's pretty much what it is from late October to May. 40, overcast. It rains a lot, but it's not heavy rain. It's just enough to get things soggy. Generally, it's not like heavy driving rain. It's not generally lots of snow, and it's generally not under sub-freezing weather. They don't have lots of snow here. It might snow once per winter, and if it does snow that one time per winter, you had better be outside when it does snow, because it's generally just not cold enough for snow, so it's generally gone. If not within 24 hours, sometimes the same day, you would not even know that it snowed if you come back 24 hours later, because it's generally just not in the 20s here, or, you know, even close to 32 degrees Fahrenheit here very regularly. It's normally 40, overcast, or it looks like it either just rained or it could rain in the next 30 seconds. That's pretty much Seattle and this area of the Pacific Northwest for, like I said, late October to May, basically. So for it to be regular, like daily for weeks on end in the 20s and 30s, I don't even remember how many times it snowed this year. I know it snowed more than five times. That is absurd. I've never seen anything like it. I'm still trying to recuperate.
Gotcha. Well, I feel sorry for you, but, you know, we get the wind chill factor up here, you know, negatives. So you're good. You're still good. I do want to say something, only because I was talking to Roz earlier. He said, you need to bring that up on the show tonight. So I just wanted to say, because the great prophet, Dr. Frances Cress Weldon, she would always say, you know, we were talking about Trump, and I was saying, you know, Weldon would always say, you know, if you're white, you're right. If you're mellow, you're yellow. If you're yellow, you're mellow. If you're brown, stick around. If you're black, get back. And I was saying, man, if you look at his presidency so far, he's attacked the yellow verbally and by canceling the trade agreement. I said he added in the red with the pipeline. I said he's been trying to keep the brown out, kick them out. I said, and, you know, you just got to get ready to brace for what he's going to do to us, because that's what the end game is always going to be, is what they're going to do to us. So I'm just waiting patiently for, you know, the other shoe to drop. I hate to use the metaphor. And I'm eating my line. Thank you.
Lots to keep an eye on. Other commentary folks wanted to make sure they get in last few minutes of the broadcast. Anything else, folks? Satisfied? Remember, move your clock up 1 hour this evening. I think that's this evening that goes down. Move your clock up 1 hour. Anything else folks need to get in before we conclude the broadcast? Soon folks are good. I'm surprised there was not more commentary on Samuel L. Jackson's remarks about British actors. I know we had talked about that before, even some year. I think it was when Selma came out. That would have been 2014, I believe, if memory is correct, right at the end of 2014 when Selma was released. But I think we were talking about it then with some of the same things that came up in the clip about the British actor David Oyelowo playing Dr. King in Selma, some of the other flicks. But most important thing, to minimize conflict between victims of racism, realizing the problem remains white people. I have not been able to see the Khalif Browder series yet. If I understand things correctly, only two parts of it have been, I think it's a six-part documentary or docu-series, as they've been calling it. I think only the first two parts have been coming out. Is that accurate? Anybody that's been keeping up? There's only two parts of it have come out so far?
Yes, but from what I understand, that on the revising, you can see the whole thing.
Okay. I will check it out and comment I'm able to see. Black mental health, extremely important. Black mental health can be one way to be able to talk to your children about racism, white supremacy. And I also think it's important, too, we talk about this with workplace racism. Talk to your children about not allowing racist children to get you upset. That's something that children do anyway, right? That's a conversation you have with your children anyway. I think it definitely should be added, the racial element to that, that these little racist kids, that they're not ignorant and they're going to do things like this. In North Carolina at Wake Forest High School, where this little race soldier was telling the black student he was going to kill his whole family, had been doing all this, and the teacher didn't do anything about all this, and then he finally just got to the point where he couldn't take it anymore and responded physically. Tell your children, hey, this is something that you need to be mindful about. These little racist children are going to try and say things, do things, particularly if they're in athletics, because I've seen quite a few reports about that, where it was basketball players, girls and boys, basketball players, or if it was soccer, football, anything, where the opposing white opponents, they will do things like that. It's been tons of incidents where they dressed up in monkey outfits and went and sat in the stands, or were throwing bananas at the players, or calling them, all kinds of things, having lynches, lynching ropes up in the stands to try to distract them. But they will do these type of things just to get you upset, and then invariably you swing or you get angry, you curse them out or you retaliate, you'll be the one that gets punished. And everyone, what are you talking about? Johnny is the sweetest boy ever. He brings us apples every morning. He's on the color. That's what it'll be. So let them know so that they can maybe do a better job. All of us, we can do a better job as attempted counter-racists at being able to be professional, manage our emotions, and just be a little bit better in how we respond to the tacky antics of white folks. With that, we should be back later in the week. You can just email to get an update if you're trying to find something in the archives and you can't find it, or if you have a guest suggestion, question, problem accessing content, just drop us an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. You can check Black Talk Radio Network, the Facebook page. All of our programs are updated the day before they air, so you can just check either spot and you should see the program, particularly on our Facebook page. If you check there, check events, you'll see all of the CALS programs, date, time, phone number, all of that information is listed. And again, if you have trouble, untiljustice@gmail.com. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I know it's the weekend, and I know seasons are about to change. If you're going to be out and about, grand. Have a good time. Let's make sure that we are not intoxicated, uncodified while we're having a good time. You do not want to be under the influence and have that be the day that you bump into Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson. Have that be the moment that you get accused of stealing a backpack. And it's, and by the way, looks like we can smell a little cannabis, or looks like you've had a few drinks, or whatever else that they can add on just to make it easier to terrorize, dominate black people. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.